6 minutes after time. And we have a historic fact that the Deputy Minister has been here for some time, and the official who are supposed to enlighten us are still on their way. Them being so important, we'll just have to wait until they're here. Right, comrade, may we get on with our work. Comrade Deputy Minister, welcome. We welcome you and your delegation, as well as the National Treasury officials. Always a pleasure to have you around, and the Auditor General of Office. Well, Comrade Deputy Minister, we always phone like can comrade, can we please get started? We would want to give you the opportunity and your officials to introduce yourself, and then the National Treasury officials as well as the Auditor General's Office and members of Parliament. And sincerely hoping that my comrades here will finally get settled. Really get settled so that we focus on the work. We can't have endless movements when we're long after 9 o'clock. So we would do that. So by the time we get into discussions, we at least know each other, and then we can engage. And also, if you do not have a copy of the program, please do indicate so that it can be made available to you. Paul will handle that. Okay. Yeah, so I'll hand over to you, Comrade Minister.
Deputy Minister.
Just switch it on, it must be read somewhere, then you can talk to him.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I think apologies from Minister Ndebele. Wednesday morning is a cabinet day, so he's involved in cabinet. So I'm here. So I'm Jeremy Cronin, Deputy Minister for Transport, and my colleagues to the left of me will introduce themselves.
Good morning, Chair. My name is George Mashalel, Director General of Transport.
Morning, my name is Collins Lizalo, Acting CEO, Road Traffic Management Corporation.
Good morning, my name is Alfred Maepa, Acting CFO of RTMC.
My name is Lerato Mulebasi, I'm advisor to the Minister, Department of Transport.
Morning, Secretary Aspetta is my name. I'm from the Department of Transport.
Morning, Dina Pele, Department of Transport.
Morning, my name is Ria Pierre. I am the chairperson of the task team that investigated this case.
Good morning, my name is Oba Munamudi. I'm a member of the task team that investigated the case.
Good morning, I'm Yvette Laroche-Kachner of National Treasury from the Office of the Accountant General.
Good morning, my name is Marissa Moore, National Treasury, Public Finance.
Thank you. Morning, Honourable Chair and Members. My name is Graham Randall, Office of the Auditor General.
Good morning, Marianne Whitford, also from the Office of the Auditor General.
Good morning, Riaz Adam, also Office of the Auditor General.
Thank you. Honorable Singh.
Yeah, Bondon. Naren Singh, KwaZulu-Natal, member of SCOPA. Thank you.
Good morning, Mark Steele, member of SCOPA.
Good morning, I'm the new member of SCOPA, member of Popular Comité for the ANC.
Morning, I'm Pete Pretorius, member of SCOPA.
Roy Ainsley, member of SCOPA.
Good morning, I'm Ruth Bengo, I'm the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Transport.
Good morning, I'm Eunice Nyandongo, I'm a member of SCOPA.
Good morning, Faith Mutambi, I'm a member of the SCOPA.
Good morning, Mujachua Mangena, member of SCOPA.
Manager Freitas, member of the Transport Portfolio Committee.
Stuart Ferrer, also a member of the Transport Committee.
Thank you very much. I'm Comrade Temba Godi. I chair this committee. All right, Comrade Deputy Minister, once again, welcome, as well as to the Director General of the Department and the leadership of the entity. As you would know, we interact on the basis of the reports that the Auditor General submit to Parliament. And in instances or cases where there are challenges or grey areas, we always seek this kind of interaction so that things could be clarified to assist in our oversight work. Well, we are also happy to be back in Parliament. This is our second hearing. Yesterday it was NASFAS with the Minister of Higher Education. Today, transport with the Deputy Minister of Transport. It is good. Right. I would want to hand over to Honorable Singh. That.
Listen, I was looking at the list of members from the department that we're expecting, but I feel that half the number that has been sent to us is not present, and I was checking if there could be any apologies to the people that are recorded on our list.
Who are you missing from the list?
From the list. From 6 up to 10.
I think that's because we didn't go to the back rows. The only person not present that I'm aware of is Lauren Senkile, but otherwise Logan Maestri, Grant Fredericks, and Thando Wababa, who are all either in the ministry or in parliamentary liaison in the ministry, are all present. So number 6, I'm not sure of the reason for Lauren Senkile not being present. He's been deployed to Free State, but otherwise we have a full complement of those on the list.
Okay. Can we, Mr. Farrell?
Just a question. This annual report was presented on behalf of a then board, and I don't see the presence of that or any reflection of that board on the attendance register, because, I mean, they should clearly also be held accountable in terms of the governing of that particular body. And I just want to query as to the reasons why they could not have been brought forward, even though that board has subsequently been suspended. The fact is that there is a reflection here in this current annual report, which I'm assuming is the topic of discussion today. And I'm just querying, maybe we can get some answers about that. Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure if you want to respond to that. Safe to say that probably our letter to them might not have been that instructive in relation to the suspended board. But if there's anything you may want to talk in that direction, you may say so. But we had thought to get the people who are currently in charge of the entity, and I'm sure it's in hearing what they have to say that we may then decide whether we feel there's a lot of unanswered questions that might require the presence of those who are personally involved. But I think that's how more or less we looked at it. So I'll say maybe let us continue with the people who are here and hear how they talk to the issues that are contained in the annual report, and then we'll determine how we'll move forward beyond that. See?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, Deputy Minister, and colleagues and officials. I just want to kick the ball literally and figuratively with a question related to World Cup tickets. And just to find out whether the tickets cost an average of about 7,500 rand, because I see the RTMC spent 1.386 million buying 186 tickets, and on an average it's 7,500. So maybe we can get an answer on that a little later. But Chairperson, I think...
Wait a minute. You want that answer a little later, or you want that answer?
Or they can give it to us now.
Go back to E.
The 1.3 million refers to the Confederations Cup tickets, not World Cup tickets.
That's doesn't matter. Talk to the figure. Is that the average for a ticket?
I don't have the figures with me here on average, but yes, for Confederations Cup, my understanding is that it was quite expensive to buy a hospitality ticket, because all those tickets are hospitality tickets. I can certainly go and look at the figures. We haven't got down to that rate of how much it was per ticket. But on average, yes, we could have been 7,500.
I think we'll need that information, Chairperson. And then you are saying to us that you didn't spend any money on World Cup.
No money on World Cup tickets. Good.
I need to be able to see you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, then the next question, general question, before I go into the specifics, is the stability of any organization, operation of any organization, dependent on management, on you having stable, permanent management. Now, in terms of the RTMC, we see that you've dismissed the CEO. You've got an acting CEO from April last year. It's, 9-10 months down the line. What I'd like to know is, what is the position with regard to management of the RTMC in terms of its staffing?
Yeah. Or maybe let's do this, because I think I omitted it. Community Minister, the issues that have been raised, I'm sure you'll be able to note them down. And then at the end, if there are issues that you would want to talk to, as well as the DG, would afford you the space. And the committee chairperson of the portfolio committee, you too, you can note issues. I'm sure at the end we'll also give you some time to talk to the issues that you feel might need to be spoken to from your angle. So just note down. Yeah, yes, you can respond to the next one.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. The appointment of the acting CEO at the RTMC was in February 2010. The reason was that the CEO is not dismissed, the CEO is on suspension. The reason was the investigation that was going to be conducted by the task team that was appointed by the minister. The task team was busy with the investigation. Then there was a decision to appoint the interim management, one, to deal with the day-to-day operations of the RTMC, and secondly, just to develop the RTMC as it were. Subsequent to that, out of the outcome of the ministerial task team, as the chair of the task team would allude to, there were recommendations that were made coming out of that. Four executive managers, one executive manager and three senior executive managers were subsequently also suspended because they were pinpointed by the ministerial task team. Insofar as the stability of the organization is fairly stable at the present moment.
Thank you for that. Chairperson, it's taken almost a year now. From the time we've had the acting CEO. Why is this inquiry taking so long? And is the CEO and the suspended managers being paid full salary and sitting at home in the meanwhile? And what is the outcome of that investigation?
The members of staff and the CEO that have been suspended, yes, they are taking a salary as per the legislation, Labor Relations Act. We have pursued disciplinary actions against them. We are following that process. To add more, out of the forensic that has been issued, the RTMC has opened a case of fraud that is going to be investigated by the police. At Boshkop Police Station, that thing has been handed over. In as far as the ministerial task team report is concerned, it was released in August, and it was then tabled, I think, in November at the portfolio committee, the recommendations of which have been implemented so far.
When you speak about narrow process being pursued, where, at what stage are we in terms of those processes?
The disciplinary processes that have been pursued at this stage have taken a point where half the time the incumbents are sick, they are legal representatives also get sick, and they've raised issues in Lehman about other issues that there's also a tendency to also go to the labor court and raise these issues at the labor court. So we wait for the outcomes of the agent applications that go to the labor court before we can proceed with those hearings. So as far as those things are concerned, we have got two where people have actually went through the process. At least the hearings have started. They have come back with proposals about severance package, but we are still proceeding with those issues. There are then three cases that are still the cases where points in Lehman have been raised, and therefore we are dealing with those matters according to the Labor Relations Act.
Chair, we're mindful of labor legislation and everything else that governs labor. But, you know, we don't seem to have a time frame. This seems to be a never-ending process. People are going to be sitting in high offices, being paid, and we don't really know when this investigation has come to an end. And we also need to know from the police, and we need the case number, if you can submit that to us at some time. How far have they gone in terms of their investigation? Because it's important for us, Chairperson, we find this with many departments, where there's a never-ending process when it comes to discipline. And then it costs the taxpayer more money to have acting people and for the organization to keep rolling. And also, Chairperson, I mean, there's one serious transgression of the past CEO, and that is budgeting for a deficit. But that's something I'll come to later. And the PFMA is very clear on that, about budgeting for a deficit. And the Auditor General has reported that. That on that score itself, I mean, the person should be, I won't say hanged, but there should be sufficient grounds for you know, serious disciplinary action to be taken.
I'm sure Jose agrees with you on that one. But when was the case opened with the police? If it's not the exact date, but more or less when?
Yeah, a week ago.
Only a week ago?
Yes.
Chair, as soon as we announced that they're going to be appearing before SCOPA, and then the case was opened. I mean, why wasn't it opened all this time? There were serious grounds here for criminal proceedings against senior officials of the department. And who is responsible for opening these charges?
No, it's fine. Let's get the answer. Why was it not opened all along until last week, until only last week?
In as far as the report, the forensic report is concerned, it's a matter that has been handled mainly by the department. Until we got an instruction to do so, we couldn't have moved. We moved once we have got the instructions to hand over the forensics to the police to investigate.
Mr. Matale, why did it take so long to implement the recommendations of the report, or at least to have taken some of the findings in the report to open a case and only have it last week?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think the challenge we were faced with, we received the final forensic report last year in September.
You said August. Or was August the final one?
Yeah.
August.
Of course, we then had to verify the report itself from the because if you look at the task team, the legal status in terms of they could challenge the report itself, the forensic report, on the basis that it was a team appointed by the task team. So we had to verify the legalities of it. So hence the delays. But at the same time, I think it is important to report that as we were doing that verification, there was engagement with the police. It's just that the actual opening of the case was last week, but there has been engagement, and other processes have been taking place before that. So the opening of the case is the culmination of a process, which handed it over a month earlier or so, we concede, but we needed to do a lot of so that we don't have legal comebacks when we go forward to this matter.
Shepherd, all right. Let's do this in the drawing. I want to allow him to just note it down. It doesn't matter, even if we're going to zigzag back and forth. Fine, but I just want to allow him to finish. Just note your question, Mr. Fowler. I'll come back to you, but I just want Honorable Singh to finish off his area of focus. Yes, continue.
Yeah, Chairperson, just on this one, if we can just ask the colleague there. Probably 6-7 million rand or 10 million rand has been paid in terms of salaries and allowances to all these people that are suspended over the last period. Will I be correct in saying that?
Yeah. Looking at the seniority and the figures, probably around 6-7 million rand.
Another 6-7 million rand as we move ahead, if this takes another year or so to finalize. But I'll just stop on that one. I think my colleagues will have follow-up questions on that, Chairperson. I want to move on to the area of focus. When we look at the Auditor General's report,
okay, maybe just stop there before you move into your area of focus. Comrade Roy, Steele, Faro.
You see, the beauty of laying charges is, as I understand it, if the NPA then decides to prosecute, you may then suspend these people without pay. Now, currently, the CEO alone is earning 1.4 million per annum. He's sitting at home now as we speak, earning 123,000 rand a month for doing nothing. So really, one hopes that the criminal charges, the police investigations, are really proceeded with very expeditiously. But you've spoken of disciplinary measures and our charges with the police against officials. Now, what about the board? What about board members? May I refer you to the annual report on page 19? Let me just read the first sentence. And it's all in terms of PFMA, accounting authorities responsible for all of these transgressions. Page 19, the first, towards the end of the page, board directors are jointly and severally liable for conducting affairs of the corporation in a manner expected of individuals in their position. Now, you've spoken only of action against officials. What about board members?
As I said, the accounting officer of the RTMC, I don't have any powers whatsoever to charge the board. What we have done is handed over a forensic to the police, and we hope that they would investigate any possible criminal charges that might come out of that. In regard to the board.
All right, that's fine. Let's hear from the DG. The accountability of the board, have they been made to account for the mess that is in this entity?
Well, I think the action which was taken, of course, was to terminate their service. The decision as to whether we pursue any disciplinary procedure has to be determined by the shareholders' committee. And I want to assume that the shareholders' committee will have to be guided by the outcomes of these other processes. Because, you know, if you look at the structure of the RTMC, you have the shareholders' committee, which is the minister and the MECs of transport. They become de facto the board. And then they delegate some responsibilities to the board. So the matter, the determination of whether they are going to charge them and so on will have to be which have to be decided by the shoulders committee. And as I said earlier,
No, that's fine. Comrade Deputy Minister, I hope you note that one. To talk about the accountability of the board. Of course, as a committee, we'll make our recommendations, but we did not appoint that board, so we can't be the ones to charge them. Those who appointed them should be able to tell us now that they have not performed. If the worst that can happen to you as a board member is to be dismissed, surely I'll be happy to be a board member anyway, because it means nothing. Still?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, there is a fiduciary responsibility that the board members carry, and I would hope that the shareholders would also be guided by the opinions of SCOPA when it comes to our recommendations with that regard. Chair, I'm concerned about the time lag and the fact that the Minister reported to the Portfolio Committee in November. I believe the Portfolio Committee indicated the charges then should be laid, and we now hear that the charges were laid a week ago in February. So there's a considerable delay, and I'm not satisfied with the explanation that we've had for that delay to date. But what I would like to say is that I believe this committee needs to see a copy of the actual charge sheet, because that must be in the public domain, and I think this committee needs to know exactly what offences people are being charged with in terms of, for example, the PFMA, in terms of Treasury regulations, so that we know which sections of the Act they are alleged to have actually breached. I think that is a detail that we need to know because of the unsatisfactory delay that has occurred.
Well, maybe still, just to say, because of what you're saying, did we open a case against specific individuals, or did we just hand over the forensic report to the police?
We handed over the forensic report for police to investigate suspicion of fraud. So that's what we did. We just, it was not specific things that we pulled out of the report. We just handed over the report as it was.
So there is no case against anybody?
Yes.
Farrell?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to reiterate the fact that at our Portfolio Committee in Transport on the 16th of November, as recorded by Mr. Steele, the Minister to that effect, when the report was presented to us, that this was clearly a recommendation of this Portfolio Committee that those charges should be laid. But I just want to also tack on to what Mr. Singh said, the Honourable Singh, relating to the delay in suspension. Normally, in terms of this process, there should be a three-month period in which those sort of suspension or those charges to that particular employee should have been laid. And from what I understand, clearly that has not taken place. This was also expressed at that portfolio committee, where I referred to judgment that had been made in terms of that procedure, and in particular, the authority that allows the suspension to take place, whether it is the Director General, whether it is the Minister, or whether, in fact, it is the acting CEO. And the judgment that came out of that particular case, I think you need to get access to, it is available, clearly defines the anomalies that took place. And this is, in effect, the reason why we are sitting here nearly a year later trying to deal with cases of this nature. And I think it's a serious indictment on the present management that they have not taken action to ensure that the labor processes in terms of what should have been followed and who was in authority in terms of the Act to be able to suspend staff should have been followed procedurally. I also want to counter the argument, Chair, that the acting CEO has just indicated in terms of the excuses for those delays. When a person is put on suspension, there has to be a procedural charge sheet laid against that individual, clearly defining what that person is suspended for. And in terms of that, there should also be the documentation to inform that particular individual. At the last hearing, which took place a week ago, I understand, there was no such thing. And the documentation had to then be scurried around, and it wasn't what was required. And the net result, there was a further delay in the suspension disciplinary hearing. I also want to tell you that if there is a suspension and a charge laid by an individual, that individual, in other words, the acting CEO who laid the charges, should be present at that disciplinary hearing. And the acting CEO was not present at that hearing, from my understanding. These are the questions I think we need to have answers to, because every day there is, as you say, 6 million rand, you know, over this period going out of the coffers of the state.
Okay. I know I must give the chance, but I want to check with the chairperson, Komlutse. I'm just trying to tie your November engagement with our engagement, because they are not parallel processes. We're one parliament. Whatever we do fits into each other. Is it your recollection understanding that in that meeting, the issues around the need to open charges against suspected fraudsters was discussed, or it was your recommendation, and or were there any objections from the department in terms of procedural issues, and what was your sense around that case? Because as we're sitting now, only a copy of the forensic report was handed to the police to investigate. There was nothing specific.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. In the meeting of the 16th of November, when we were dealing with this issue, the Portfolio Committee on Transport recommended that if those that are responsible should be charged.
All right. No, that's fine. I want to give Honorable De Freitas.
Yes. Thank you, Chair.
And then just a minute, and then it will be Matladi, Hoshi, Shiane, and then Dambe. Please, Victoria, read the back part of that report in the meantime. We'll give you some time. I want thing to continue. Remember, it still has a substantive part of his focus area to deal with. Freitas?
Thank you, Chair. In the last 20 minutes, I've been observing this conversation. This is the biggest exercise in ducking and diving that I've seen in a long time, from the department and from the RTMC. Firstly, I note, for example, that my colleague, Stuart Farrow, asked a number of questions pertaining to suspensions of staff. And he asked the question of all entities, of which all responded except the RTMC, who said they will revert the responses in due time. Well, we're still waiting. The sad thing is that we actually have the information. But not because we're particularly clever, because that department is so filled with mistrust and people who are so afraid of each other in that department, that entities actually become dysfunctional. And that's the truth of the matter. So all these other issues must be understood in an environment where, first of all, RTMC simply is not fulfilling their mandate, and it can be very easily proven.
I would want to. I hear you, and issues you're raising are valid and relevant. I would want to redirect us to at least direct questions arising out of what has already been tackled. Otherwise, the generic and general issues and challenges that are there in the entity, I think we know them, we understand them. But I want us to raise questions.
I'll do so, Chair.
Or follow up. Just a question.
Chair, and I want to reiterate what the Honourable Singh said earlier. Can we have specific timeframes on resolutions of certain issues? In particular, the continuing payment of big bucks to people who have been suspended, and continue to be earning money, sitting at home, relaxing. So if we could, as part of that, have definite time frames and definite commitments from the department, that we can resolve these issues. Thank you.
Okay. Can we respond to the issues raised by the two comrades at the bank around processes, procedures of suspension, and the issues around time frames?
Those issues are the issues that have been raised as matters in Lime by the
people. What is Lime?
Those are procedural issues that are raised before we can actually get into the hearing. For instance, they would say, in their view, the minister or the shareholders committee do not have the power to appoint an acting CEO. And therefore, in their view, this acting CEO's appointment is null and void, and therefore that means that they can't be charged by that person. So those are the issues. In as far as the finalization of this, for us it's important that, as I said, there are two out of the four members of EXCO that have been suspended. There are two that have come forward to say, can you give us, the other one has proposed 6 months, the other one has proposed 4 months, so they can get their appearance packages and then we can cut ties in terms of that. We have taken that, we have tabled it in front of the chair of the shareholders committee to determine whether that makes economic sense or not. So once that is completed, we'll be able to complete this issue. In as far as all the other...
You also need to check whether it makes criminal sense or not. I mean, yeah. If they're fraudsters, why should we just terminate their services with them?
We were looking at two things. We were looking at criminal processes that are busy continuing with the police, and the issue about the relationship that the RTMC has with these people, which is an employment relationship. So severing the employment relationship and paying out whatever they would determine does not actually stop the criminal processes. And that's what we have tabled in front of the minister, and that decision is going to be made soon as to whether we are proceeding or how we're going to deal with that matter. That's what I'm saying. In as far as the finalization of this is concerned, my hands are quite tight in the sense that there are processes that are followed. If someone goes to the labor court and gets an agent interdict, whether I have a hearing going on or not, I must stop until the finality of that is finalized. So I cannot at this stage give any determination on the date on which this is completed.
That's fine. I want us to be short and focused so that we don't might end up 12 o'clock without having really gone into the substantive issues.
Chairperson, I'm going to be very short
right.
And to the point. I would like to find out from the department why they couldn't quantify the costing on staff, on equipment, property and plant. And if they're answering about the staff, they must be able to explain why there were some staff members that were dedicated to the functions of the RTIA and at the same time other administrative staff that were doing or performing functions of the RTIA.
Right.
So they've got to clarify
right.
That. Yeah.
Once again, like yesterday, we'll deal with that question last. Please. No, I'm hoping that comrades are making follow-up on the issues that Singh had raised, so that we don't raise new issues. Please. Hosh.
Thanks, Chairperson. The issue of case. Chair, one sitting where I am was of the view that the suspended, you know, officials were suspended on the basis of, you know, alignment with the maladministration that we're talking about here. Therefore, to hand the report, you know, in a blank and said, look, read the report and find who is in there. I don't think that's enough, Chair. I was of the view that all the suspended individuals on the basis of the report will then be, you know, named to say Chairperson Godi is the suspect on the basis of he failed to deal with this particular thing. He procured, you know, this amount of money without following the necessary, because immediately you procure a certain whatever, without following the procedures. It's on itself is an element of, you know, suspicious that you were doing it deliberately knowing that you wanted to throw something out of where it's supposed to go.
Okay.
Why don't they just, you know, all those suspended officials
being named and said, this one, that one, that one, we suspect here. Because when you name the person, you are not giving a judgment. You are saying, this is a suspect on this particular matter. Can you deal with this matter? The police will be able to investigate and go into detail. But when you just give, even themselves, they might not be having that, you know, courage to go through. Let there be, you know, names. To me, then, in the light of submitting a report, it's not a case opening. Because a case should be open against something.
Okay. All right. I'll come to you.
Chairperson, I get a sense of a lack of a backbone on this matter. You get a report, you have already suspended people like advocate is saying it there, Koshi is saying it there. You get a report, there are names contained in that report. I'm very interested to see that report because I definitely know that there will be names in that report. Names of the staff members, probably even names of board members. Why go to the police and give them just a report? Are the board members not printed in there? Are you afraid to take action? And basically, to me, sitting here, it says somebody does not want to take action. But action must be taken. Because it's a lot of money that is being spent on a monthly basis to pay these people and the department and yourself, that must act and act accordingly and see this. I understand the issue of the court interdict. It's to buy time. But you can always get a legal opinion on how to go about it. No severance packages, please. We're losing a lot of money as government, taxpayers' money, on paying people who have done extremely wrong things in this country. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, and then, Pretoria, you are the absolute last fire event like to say, please.
Thank you, Chair. On disciplinary hearings, partly I'm covered by Honorable Machine, but looking at this 10 months, I'm tempted, 10 months suspension period, I'm tempted to ask this question on the issue of the appetite to discipline. I believe you have advised the presiding officers for the hearing, also the prosecutors for the hearing, and I'm interested to know the cause thus far, because this excuse is like she said, to say either the one is sick, either one is on study leave, whatever, it doesn't hold water. I would like the breakdown of how much have you paid thus far to those consultants that you are using, because I believe you are not doing it in-house. Secondly, Comrade Roy raised the issue of the board. Why was it not disciplined? And you responded that is the duty of the shareholders committee. I think you need to also take us on board to ask, because according to the report, it said that shareholder only met once, shareholder committee only met once instead of four times, as required by the Road Traffic Management Corporation Act. So can you also share with us, or the minister will have to speak to it? Because definitely we are in this situation because the shareholders committee meetings couldn't even perform its functions as required by Section 28 of the same Act.
Okay, thank you. Pretoria?
I'm halfway covered by the last comment. I also wanted to refer to the annual report on page 80, where it refers to the shareholders committee that only met once. My worry is about the actual governance, the leadership, the remaining leadership in the organization. Because we've just heard that of the 10 or so executive management members, 3 or 4 or 5, I'm not sure how many, were suspended. And of the remaining few that are left, 2 or 3 of them are in acting capacities in any case. There is no board, and then the shareholders committee, which is supposed to take over the functions of the board, met once, where they should have met 4 times last year. So there's a total lack of commitment to manage this institution. My question then is, what's happened since then in the current financial year? Is there more serious attempt by the shareholders, at least, to meet more regularly and take ownership of this institution?
All right. Let's do it this way. I think, what is coming through from these comrades is that we are not happy with the speed at
which you are moving, especially in relation to opening criminal charges against individuals that you suspended, and I believe the correctness of your decision was confirmed by the report of the investigating team. We would like you to open cases against specific individuals because there are specific people mentioned, and you suspended specific people. You had reasons, prima facie evidence against these people, and the investigation should actually have consolidated your case. We're not happy with that. If there are issues around that, you should be able to tell us, this parliament, say, I'm scared to try these guys because of 1234. Otherwise, it reflects poorly on the current management, that you don't have the backbone to take firm and decisive action against wrongdoers. And this issue is being raised for the second time in Parliament, because when you came in November, that was the position of the Portfolio Committee. And here we are in mid-February. We still do not have any single individual who has been charged for fraudulent or alleged fraudulent activities in that entity. So, Comrade Deputy Minister, I want that one to be underlined. That's our firm position. We are not happy with the way in which everything has been done. It would have been good to have been here yesterday and hear the chairperson of NASFAR and the DG of Higher Education. We felt that the tone and the oomph, in especially dealing with wrongdoers, was at the correct level. And so we think on this one. The second element, Comrade Deputy Minister, relates to the board and the responsibilities that the politicians have as shareholders. Because it might as well be that that's actually the root of the problem. Because the tone was set at the top, at the political level, coming to the DG and then sent to everybody. At that level, you don't have that strong sense. Then it permeates everywhere. And it might as well be that every other thing that we're going to discuss will be pointless unless we head on deal with this question around the role of the shareholder. So I was strongly tempted in that direction, but I've resisted that temptation. Say, no, let us continue with what we have. But I'm just saying, when you have time, I think it is a point that you need to respond to very thoroughly and in some detail. And if it elicits questions, for once, I'll allow comrades to maybe engage with it, because I think it is almost a numb for me. Honorable Sin?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think, you know, whilst we're all aware, South African motorists are aware that the Department of Transport and the RTIA in particular have a reputation for fining people for infringements, and speeding is an infringement. In this case, speeding will not be an infringement. Deal with this as quickly as possible. And I don't think you have to go further than Section 86 of the PFMA. Offences and penalties are quite clear. Read with Section 38 and 39, accounting officers' responsibilities relating to budgetary control, and Section 38, a charge can be opened on that. And it might be a good test case for the country. This will be the first charge against any accounting officer in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. Otherwise, it's just written here, and it will remain written here for another 20 years. So here's a chance for you to be the torchbearer, or the, what you call it, the person who runs ahead in terms of PFMA. Chairperson, thank you. And I think, Chairperson, the other thing we've got to do, we are aware from the annual report of the names of the board members. We're all aware. We know they were negligent. There has to be a system where all other public entities and departments need to know who these individuals are. Because if they were negligent in one department or one entity, you're going to find them also not carrying out their responsibility in another department. But I can bet my bottom dollar, and I don't have many, that they would already have been appointed as board members in other entities in the country.
Okay, all right. That's
thank you.
Let's
Chairperson, coming back to what the Auditor General has said, there are two areas which have caused the entity to receive an adverse audit opinion. One is relates to the RCI and separate financial statements, and the other is the fiscal sustainability of the corporation or the organization. Now, in terms of the RTIA, we note from the minister's speech on the 16th of November, I think, to the portfolio committee, that it is you have got a board in place, you've taken steps to correct the RTIA. It's also been listed in terms of Schedule 3, which are positive steps. But we are here dealing with this period of 2009 to 10, and we need to ask, why did this situation take place? Where the financial statements, as the Auditor General has said here, you failed to submit separate financial statements. And this has caused consequences to RTMC financial statements. Why did it happen? And I note that in 07-08, 08-09, you received unqualified audit opinion. But suddenly in 09-10, it was adverse related to this particular issue. Can we have an explanation?
Thank you very much. The clean audit.
Talk about the financial statements. Why were they not done separately? Leave the rest out.
Okay. The financial statements for 9-10 included that, and you'll see that we adjusted for 08-09. On the 08-09, it was never accounted for. 9-10, we had to account for the money that was coming in and out of the RTMC and the money that we're spending in the RTMC.
Yeah, but why didn't you do separate financial statements? I think that's the question. Just respond to that.
My understanding as far as that you are concerned is the fact that the then management and the then board had a thinking that RTIA was going to be collapsed into RTMC to form one entity. And therefore, in their view, they were doing those things as if the organization was going to be one going forward.
All right, let's continue. I hope you know that complete, Minister. Yesterday, we were having a challenge. You have an entity where in 1 year you have three CEOs. Now, while it might be that leadership acts against errant officials, but it also raises the question, how do we get them employed in the first place? This person is employed for 5 years and within a year is suspended already. Now, in their thinking, I don't know what informed their thinking, because what should inform your thinking in terms of the legal status of any entity is what should be in the law. If there is no law that says that, what triggers your fertile imagination? Fine, you thought they were going to be collapsed into one, but they were not yet collapsed. So it comes back to the quality of people, the orientation of the people that we employ. I think that's how far we can go with it. Anyway, that's the explanation. They thought it was going to be collapsed, so they may as well preempt it and report as one.
I think it also begs the question, when did Section 14, brackets 3 of ARTO come into play? Because there it's quite clear you should have separate financial statements. Was it after RTIA was formed in 2007 or, you know, much later? Or during in 2007, when the Act gave rise to RTIA, because Section 14.3 here was infringed.
RTIA comes into existence through the promulgation of the Act that possibly happened in 2007. Then there is a point where in the municipal areas of Gauteng, of Joburg and Tshwane, there is a process where that starts. What you then see is where the board, some members of the board of the RTMC become interim members of the board of RTIA. RTIA is not formally established. It therefore does not have an accounting officer. It has an interim board that is within the board of the RTMC. And that's when all those things started to happen. It was at that time.
Okay. All right.
Okay, yeah. Chair, I don't think there's any point in pursuing that particular issue. I think let's go on to the fiscal sustainability RTMC. Now,
Honorable Singh goes to the fiscal sustainability. I asked a question on the traffic infringement agency, and then you said it would come at the end. The one on the costing on staff, it comes before the fiscal.
Okay, yeah. Good. Just repeat your question.
So my question is, they have to explain why they couldn't quantify the costing on staff, on property, plant, and equipment. Because also on staff, we find some people who have been dedicated to the RTIA, and then also the administrative staff that is doing part of the functions of the RTIA. So they've got to explain why they couldn't quantify this costing. Thank you.
The rollout of ARTO is a function of both of the entities, and therefore it becomes very difficult to say if you have hired a person, unless the one that was hired, being the deputy registrar at the time, was the only one that you could specifically say this person belongs to RTIA. In as far as our functions as per the Act our function number 10 is ARDO and ARDO implementation that RTMC is responsible for. As I said, part of the explanation is because at the time there was a thinking that this thing is going to be one thing, so all the costs were collapsed into one.
I didn't get your explanation on why didn't you quantify the costing.
I'm saying the split becomes difficult because if you were sitting there, the implementation of ARTO is a dual process. Road Traffic Infringement Agency is also responsible for certain portions of ARTO implementation, whereas Road Traffic Management Corporation is also responsible for certain portions of ARTO implementation. And I'm saying, because of that, the split became difficult. Also, given the fact that at the time there was a thinking that all these things were all in one, and therefore they were collapsed into one, it becomes very difficult to delineate and say this cost belongs to ARTO, RTIA, this cost belongs to RTMC.
Okay. Now, I don't want us to draw blood from a stone, you see, because you had a management that whose thinking was just, I don't know. So that's the root of your problem. You can talk to all these issues and go this way and that way, but the root cause is that you had people who were sitting in management offices. I don't know whether they were thinking like cowboys or what, but they just had a thinking that did not belong to the positions they were sitting at.
Chair, before Mr. Singh moves on to sustainability, before you leave this particular issue, the Auditor General makes some very specific recommendations regarding RTIA, that they should be listed as a separate entity. I believe that's been done. But he also recommends that they are fully operational with their own financial systems. So you don't have this conflation between their financial statements and those of the RTMC. Has that now been done? If not, what are the time frames?
Yes, that has been done. They have got an acting registrar. They have got an acting CFO. They are in separate buildings. They are doing what they have got to do. We have finalized that. But I must question the committee that there is a still work that is done by the RTMC as provided for in terms of Regulation 2 of the other regulations, where we have got to perform certain administrative functions on behalf of the agency.
Sure, I think the question, do they have systems in place to ensure that there can be a separation? Mamba Sadi raised these issues about staff, you know, aligning them, charging them to RTIA and not RTMC. Do you have systems? You have warm bodies there, but do you have systems in place to ensure that these things that happened in the past don't happen in the future?
Definitely. That has been implemented.
All right. Honorable Farrell?
I just want to reiterate something.
There seems to be a merging of a whole series of processes here, which are depicted clearly in the Act. The one relates to the establishment of the Road Traffic Infringement Agency, and the other in terms of the implementing part of the Act, which is the administration and adjudication of the actual infringement systems. Clearly, they are very defined, and I think that this committee should get copies of that Act to have a look at them, to see whether, in fact, they have been followed correctly. That's the first thing, because although the acting CEO is claiming here that there is a certain amount of merging of responsibilities, if that was the case, then it would require for him to have come back to the Portfolio Committee to adjust any particular section of the Act or amend it accordingly to accommodate this particular thing. There has been a clear infringement on his part in terms of what has happened here in the failure to comply with those particular sections of the Act. Finished and clock. And I think you should get copies of those three particular pieces of legislation to have a look at very carefully, Chair.
All right. Okay. All right.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, on page 109 of the annual report, Mr. Lasala, the acting CEO, says there, the financial statements have been prepared on the going concern basis. But when you look at the finances and sustainability of this organization, it doesn't seem to be a going concern organization. It's a gone organization. It seems to have gone because of the losses that have been incurred. Now, we can talk about the RTIA adjustments of a few million here and there. But then in the year under review, there was a net loss of 84.773 million. Now, what gave rise to this net loss? And the Auditor General has also reported that the accounting officer or the entity at that time budgeted for a deficit. Now, that's a clear, clear prohibited act in terms of the law to budget for a deficit. So they either knowingly budgeted for a deficit in the forecast or managed the organization in such a way that there was a deficit of 88 million. What was it? Because according to the AG, they budgeted for a deficit. And that's clearly prohibited.
Yes, there was budgeting for a deficit, as there was utilization of transaction fees that were meant for inities that were used by RTMC instead of being transferred to the DOT as is expected. The reason for us going forward was to look at our sustainability going forward on a going concern basis. Yes, indeed, if you look at our balance sheet, you'd see that there's an issue of technical insolvency in the establishment itself. The reason of the technical insolvency is because for as long as on the DOT side, there's still an expectation that this money that were already spent by ourselves must be coming. Then there's a liability on our side to still be able to pay that money over to the DOT. So our liabilities at year end would be more than our assets as a result. And going forward, until that time that we have regularized that process, we would also see that then asset and liabilities, our liabilities will continue to be above our asset for as long as that money has not been written off in the books of the DOT. We still have to record it as an expectation from DOT that we must pay those monies that were spent that we're not supposed to be spending.
DG, comments please on this one.
Yeah, no. A bit of the background, the genesis of this problem was precisely this point. Because when we came in, we found that they were using money which was supposed to come to us. And we stopped that immediately. We found that they didn't have their own independent financial systems. But already at the time, they'd spent, I can't remember now, more than 200 million, which was supposed to come to us. And we stopped that. And that basically thing. So, as to the funding challenge for the RTMC, that issue still with us. There are discussions going on between ourselves and the RTMC and Treasury to resolve that question. We have not yet resolved it moving forward, but it is a problem. Let me just add on this one, Chair, if you allow me. The major problem we're dealing with here is a management team which was facing difficult financial problems, then deciding because of that they would violate everything to respond to that challenge. I mean, that's essentially what this is about. And they decided, no, we're not going to hand over money to the department, we'll just use it against the regulation. We are going to, we have this problem of functional creep between ourselves as RTMC and RTIA, and the logic is that moving forward we need to look at the integration of the two.
So it was some further shock kind of operation going on.
Essentially, that's the problem.
Okay.
That's the problem. So we can go into this coma or that full stop and so on. Essentially, what we're dealing with is that. So what we're trying to do now through the ATCO is to correct that, to clean the system, to allocate functions and responsibilities and financial management where it belongs.
Okay.
And that's a big challenge. And part of that challenge is we therefore engage in Treasury to try and resolve these things.
No, when people go to Treasury, they want money.
Has Treasury been approached in this matter?
Treasury?
Thank you, Chair. Yes. The Department of Transport approached the National Treasury in 2007-08 initially to arrange for the United transaction fees to flow, as the DT indicated, to the department, as the function of EMISIS is a departmental function and not the RTMC function. However, when we noticed in 2008-09 that some of this money is being held back by the RTMC, the department did approach the National Treasury and request that we resubmit. Maybe I can just clarify for the committee, the initial flow of money did flow through the RTMC for monitoring purposes, but they were supposed to monitor and pay the money to the department. The department then requested that we change the practice note so that the funds don't flow to the RTMC at all. However, because of a regulation published by the minister in July 2007, the Treasury was unable to change the flow of funds because we can't go against what is already in regulation. So we are still facing that problem that the function is with the department, but there is, if you want to call it a loophole, allowing the RTMC to collect transaction fees. We believe that regulation is ultra vires the Act. The Act says they can collect those fees if they perform the function. But as they are not performing the function, obviously the contract lies with the department. So there is, if you want to call it, a bit of a legal problem to ensure that we collect the funds at the right level.
Essentially, what you're saying is that the regulations are actually going against the law.
Yes, sir.
I hope, Comrade Deputy Minister, you can note that as well. Because, I mean, how do we show each department has legal advisors and all that? I mean, really, what are they being paid for if we have regulations that, you know, are made that clearly violate legislation? And we're in a limbo for almost 4 years. I didn't think bureaucracy was that bad. It would take us 4 years to change something that should actually assist us, enable us, make our work smoother.
Chair, and if we have this kind of cavalier attitude amongst managers in all, say, most of our entities in government, then there's no need for PFMA, no need for regulations, no need for anything. Do what you like, when you like. And in fact, I think I was the one who mentioned Spaza shop here one day. and I was criticized by somebody in the newspaper saying, hey, spaza shops run better, so don't criticize us and use us as a benchmark, as a low benchmark. They run better. So we'll move away from that. But I think here, in 10-11, DG is going to have the same problem. I think the AG is going to report the same thing. You're going to get another adverse audit opinion because you haven't been able to sort this thing out. But whilst all this was happening, I just want to talk about internal controls within the RTMC. Because, you know, you can spend this money, you do what you like. What was the internal control mechanisms like? Did they have an internal control?
Are you done with fiscal?
On the same, on the sustainability.
Okay. Maybe let's postpone that question as a direct question. Then we'll come to it later, or I'll allow you to ask it when we're dealing with some of the issues that might have to be raised later. Just hold on a minute. Bill Farrow, and then I'll check with you, seeing if you are done. If not, you continue. If you are, then we'll go to Comrade Roy. Yes, Bill?
Thank you, Chair. As a follow-up on the sustainability issue, looking at the paragraph on page 111, fiscal sustainability, the entity's current liabilities exceed its total assets by 134 million. Now, we've heard about the problem of liabilities, and clearly that is part of the issue relating to the information the Treasury has provided. But part of that assets exceeding liabilities must surely also relate to what is given to us on page 152, where under operating expenses, they report on the third line, assets written off and intangible assets retired have gone from 471,000 to 27 million.
What is it? What which page is that?
Page 152.
Just wait. Wait for it. Page 152.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Now, this huge dramatic increase in assets written off, I can't find any explanation as to why that is the case. If this is just depreciation, then it sounds to me like it's depreciation that's been happening over 4 or 5 years that's suddenly been recorded in these financials for the very first time. Otherwise, quite clearly, there's been no proper asset management and control and verification for years. So could we please have some explanation with details as to what exactly was written off, what was retired, and more to the point, why was the proper depreciation policy not followed over the last few years?
Okay.
I'll ask the CFO to touch on the other issues. But 17 million of this asset written off refers to the 17 million that is fruitless and wasteful expenditure on an ERP system that the one that we have actually reported as irregularly procured of about 33 million. The rest, I think, is the cars that are not for our use, but they were actually in our assets, but they have been used by provinces. Just that.
Okay, just leave out the explanation on the regular expenditure. I'm sure we'll deal with it later, but then just explain the other part.
I think Chairperson, as the acting CEO is saying, basically it's the ERP that was retired, because in terms of the assessment, we realized that it's an expensive system to maintain going forward. I think the cost for maintenance going forward was almost 8 million per year. So we then decided that we are not going ahead with that. So we had to retire 17 million of that. The second portion of the 10 million is cars that were procured around 2008, 2007 that were transferred to provinces. Basically what we then had to do is just to make sure that they then take ownership of them and we transfer them at book value.
Thank you. It relates to the eNatus transaction fee and its sustainability.
First of all, I want to establish, and I think we need to know, there had to be some judiciary responsibility as to who authorized the use of that money that should have gone to Treasury. There was a clear memorandum of understanding that was undertaken between the RTMC as the collecting agent for that transaction fee and also the department and the Treasury. It was there was an agreement which clearly indicates that that money had to be collected from the provinces and then transferred to Treasury. Now, somewhere along the line, somebody made the decision to utilize that funds, which I see, unfortunately, is still excluded in the deficit of 134 million. If there was 300 odd million of that money also used, it makes the situation even worse as far as I'm concerned. And I want to know whether we know who that was. Was it the board's decision? Was it the CEO or the acting CEO's decision to decide to utilize that money illegally? Because there's an onus of responsibility there, judicial responsibility in terms of that agency. So I would expect that we can have that answer, Chair.
Okay.
And I want to know whether, in fact, under the current watch, that is not continuing.
Okay. Yeah, I think the digital transport said that was stopped. So money is transferred to the department now. Or are we still having that challenge?
Yeah, no. As I said, as a report, it was stopped in October 2009. Yeah.
So, INET's money flows
to
every cent of it.
Yes. The issue you were referring to as to when was that it was the CEO with the board. And the task team, if you look at the report of the task team, the board was asked specifically. And they said they were briefed by the CEO, that they have the authority to use that money.
So we have a board of unknowledgeable people who are just pulled by the nose. Whatever the CEO says, they are there to put a stamp of approval. All right. Now that's fine. I want us to move to Comrade Roy, but not before Comrade Chilwane. Here's the word.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to make a follow-up in terms of the response from the CFO on the transfer made to provinces of about 10 million. Is it possible through you, Chair, that we can get a breakdown of how much was transferred to the provinces per each province, or how many cars have been purchased, if we can get just that kind of a breakdown. Thank you.
Can we get that?
No, certainly we can. I don't have the figures now, but certainly we can do that.
No later than next week, we'll take it up.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Comrade Roy?
Comrade Chair, you have spoken about wrongdoing. Those were your words, wrongdoing, in this entity. I think it's time now that we started putting some figures onto the costs of this wrongdoing. So I'm going to deal with the Auditor General's report, page 111, and the emphases of matter. There are three issues that I want to deal with. Restating the corresponding figures, irregular expenditure, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Let us start with a restatement of corresponding figures, and I want people who have the AG's report, the annual report, to turn to note 10 on page 133, where it gives a little bit more detail. Now, I'm not going to spend too much time on that because it is a matter that occurred in the past financial year. If you look at that, page 133, the very first set of figures at the top of the page, it is a matter that occurred in the last financial year, not this one. But also, a large part of the error was a result of these e-notice transaction fees used with no authorization that we've already heard of from the Treasury, from the DG, and from Mr. Farrer. So I'm not going to deal too much with that, except to say, what figure are we talking about? What is the quantum of the unauthorized use of these transaction fees. What figure are we talking about? Because if you look at that table, there, to me, it seems the transaction fees we are looking at is about 68 million. If you turn to the irregular expenditure on page 148, in that column there of irregular expenditure, there's an item, irregular utilization of transaction fees without approval. I'm assuming we're talking about the same thing, innate transaction fees. There the figure is 200 million. So if we can just, I want clarification as to what is the figure that we are talking about when we say that these amounts were not authorized and they were used by the entity. What, please, what figure?
Thank you. The figure on page 133, that is 68 million, refers only to transaction fees that were utilized in 08-09.
Okay.
The 200 million that is reflected as regular expenditure covers the 2 years, that is including 9-10.
So those, so these things were used in an unauthorized way also in the current financial year?
Current financial year is 9-10, the year under review.
I see. The other question I've got on that item is, do you have an offset policy? Because these things were offset against expenses. Now, I'm told that you need an offset policy, that you can only offset A or B if you have a legally enforceable right obligation to do so. Is there an offset policy that the entity has with regard to these kinds of figures?
No, we don't have an offset policy. I think basically what has happened here, there was a number of projects that were identified to be funded from transaction fees in terms of the strategic plan for 9-10. But we don't have an offset policy, but we basically know what spent for in terms of transaction fees.
Can you give us an indication of what the money was used for?
The money was basically used, let me just refer to the project. There were a number of projects, I think one of them, or the ARS system, accident reporting system.
But you want to refer to a page. Are you able to refer to a page so we can all...
Okay. It should be on page... On page 152, you will see that there are projects under ARTO for 95 million, and there are projects under ENETIS for only 2 million, but also there are other expenses that will be sitting under certain line items. For example, under your professional fees and stuff like that, they will be managed in there. But in the main, the ARS system was procured.
So in short, it was used for a whole range of
other things, definitely. Yeah.
I think that's better. Otherwise,
a lot of your operation expenditure came down from the illegal use, the unauthorized use of these funds. And that practice, you now desist from that practice. The acting CEO is nodding, but you give us an assurance that you're no longer following this practice.
We are no longer using any money that are in it is related. We are using only what we have out of our appropriation.
So we won't see this as an emphasis of matter this time around next year?
Definitely not.
Chair, may I deal with irregular expenditure, please? On page 148 of the annual report, there are two tables there. The one indicates irregular expenditure for 2009, the other for 2010. If you add up 2009 column, I get irregular expenditure of about 13,207,197 rand. That's 2009. There's an enormous increase. If you look at the 2010 figure, the figure for 2010 is well over 360 million, a dramatic increase in irregular expenditure from the previous financial year. Also in these figures, there are 8 or 9 items listed there under irregular expenditure. But in these figures, I don't see any reference to an irregular lease agreement. I'm looking at the speech the minister gave to the portfolio committee in November. In that speech, the portfolio committee, he said the task 15 relates an irregular lease agreement of 658 million rand over 10-year period. The actual loss on this lease is estimated 11 million rand. Now, that's irregular, but I can't find it unless it's disguised there somewhere on one of those items. I can't find any reference to this irregular lease agreement. Is that included there in the table?
No, it's not included in the table. And a lot of other irregular expenditure that are then uncovered by the forensic investigation are not included because at the time we had already closed our books. When we...
Sorry, is it me?
When we got the forensic report, we had already closed our books, and that you would see in the year that is coming, in 10-11, will be reported.
Okay, so I estimate irregular expenditure in terms of this annual report at over 360 million. If we are to add these other figures, what kind of actual figure are we looking at? And I don't know, are we to add 658 million rand to this list, or are we to add 11 million rand to this list? Because you see, if it was irregular, it doesn't matter if you got value out of the lease. And as a result of getting value out of the lease, you only lost 11 million rand. That's not the question at issue. Irregular remains irregular. And so I'm almost tempted, it's mind-boggling, and I'm almost nervous to do it. But I would add 658 million rand to this list of irregular expenditure. You're nodding your head. I mean, it's just simply mind-boggling. Do I add that 658 million to my list?
Yes, you do.
And then what?
But that will appear only in year 10-11.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah, I think all it's trying to do is, what are the cumulative figures that we have if we have to?
When I began adding up these figures, my little calculator gave up at 200 million rand. It wouldn't respond to anything above 200 million. I doubt if I'd get these figures onto my calculator. It's very mind-boggling. Can you explain to us, please, what has happened? Because clearly, it seems to me, there's been almost a total collapse of internal control between 2009. Well, 13 million, one could almost live with, I suppose. But close to a billion, one cannot. There seems to have been an almost total collapse of financial control. Where was the internal control? Where was the audit committee? And by the way, I don't see a report from the audit committee in the annual report. What were they doing? They were meant to be watching this, anticipating this kind of thing. Give us some kind of explanation as to what happened.
Yeah,
total collapse in internal control.
Yes, there was a total collapse in internal control, which is what we are trying to build currently. The reason why you wouldn't normally see that irregular expenditure on that would be because it becomes expenditure once the money has been spent. And if it hasn't been spent, then you can't declare it as irregular expenditure. That's where we are. So in the lease, what we'll look at is how much we have spent of the money that we have committed ourselves to, and we'll declare that as irregular expenditure.
So are you confirming that there was no audit committee in the entity?
There was a dysfunctional audit committee. There was a committee. It rarely ever sat. There are a couple of people that then withdrew from the audit committee and resigned, and they were not replaced, and therefore there was no audit committee.
Internal audit?
Internal audit existed.
Outsourced?
No, it was not outsourced. It was in. What I can tell the committee is that the day I arrived, the next day, the day two of me at the RTMC, the head of internal audit was caught stealing documents out of the establishment, taking them away before the ministerial task team arrived, was caught red-handed, and he has been since dismissed by a properly constituted disciplinary hearing. He has went to the CCMA. We have won that case altogether as well. It was dismissed. So the person has been dismissed since.
Why was he not arrested, and why were criminal charges not properly against him?
We haven't pursued any criminal charges against the person, but he has since been dismissed from the organization.
Well, dismissal is almost like a slap on the wrist. He's probably got a key position somewhere else in the Silver Service. Painful as it is, I think we may have to go through some of these individual items that are listed on page 148. Perhaps you can give us some explanation as to what happened, who is responsible, give us names, and what action has been taken against that person. There are about 8 or 9 items listed there. Let's start at the top. Purchase of the accident reporting system, irregular expenditure of over 59 million rand. We're told that this bid went out of without a proper bid process. Why? Who was responsible? And we are told that initially, if you look at the notes there on page 148, initially the contract went to the Department of Transport. Initially. The wording suggests the contract did not stay with the department. Where did this contract finally land up there? So if you can give us some kind of explanation as to where the final contract lay, who is responsible for this, what action has been taken.
And who got that contract?
And that's what I'm saying. Where did it finally, who finally? Initially it was the Department of Transport.
Yeah.
It's very vague as to where it landed up.
That issue was investigated by the Ministerial Task Team, and I think they would be the better people to answer and give you all the names.
I imagine that task team would have reported to you, and that you immediately would have rushed off to the nearest police station.
The name of the contractor is Lefasi Technologies. I think it's right at the CDG to hand over the Ministerial Task Team report to the chairperson, so that the chair can see what has been in there. The way it took form was that there is a provision in the regulation, as far as treasury is concerned, to allow an organ of state to participate in a tender that has been issued by another organ of state. And this is how it happened. It looks as if the department had a contract which was meant for something totally different. But in terms of the regulations, it says if it's for the same thing. So you can't change that and change it to suit you. So they were supposed to participate in a tender of the Department of Transport for the same purpose. This was not for the same purpose. And that's what made it even more irregular.
Procurement of professional services without following procurement processes. And there, it's 12 million for 2010, and the 9 million for 2009 was only discovered in the current financial year. So if you can speak to both of those items, what happened there? Who was responsible for this? And what action has been taken? And I see one service provider of that 12 million was appointed to a 10 million contract without approval from the Finance Committee. Now, who was responsible for that? Who received this? Who was the service provider?
Deloitte
and Poch.
Yes, the accounting firm. What you see is in 2008-09, when RTMC is supposed to submit its own financial, it has got a fully functional finance unit, but then hires Deloitte to do everything on the financial to the tune of 10.8 million.
Was the finance committee aware of this?
I can't be sure about the finance committee being aware of it, but my understanding is that it was it had to go. Initially, it was not, because it looks like This contract was for, was it for 3 million?
What, 1.3.
So for 1.3 million and got extended and extended to a point where it got to about that, and then it has been taken to the board to ratify.
And is this contract still in force?
No. Because they did their work, they did what they called a clean finance cleanup. That's what they called it. The project was called cleanup. Maybe it explains why in 08, 09 we had a clean audit report.
Mr. Singh is mumbling that as he won't ask a question.
Okay. All right. Yes, Mr. Farrell?
I think you short-circuit this process, and I want to just make you aware of the fact that there is a concise and very detailed report relating to this. Mr. Emsley's calculator wouldn't add it up, which you're not getting in terms of the current report, as the acting CEO has said that there was a closure of the books prior to investigation taking place. There was also a forensic audit undertaken by Gobodo at some other cost to this particular company, together with the ministerial task team, which of which is listed, and we have, as a part, as a portfolio committee, have requested that we have the full copy of that report so we can interrogate it and do our oversight role, because right now all we've got is the same figures that you've got in our presentation, which is very broad based, and we would like to reiterate again that we need that full report, which was promised to us in November. Now, if you can get your copy, your hands on that, together with the Gobodo forensic report, I think a lot of your minds will be eased, and you will be very much more informed as to where we are at the current position, because obviously the AG had a job to do and picked up clearly where they saw fit certain anomalies. But I think in that particular report now, we need to get down to bottom line, and we need to interrogate that report rather than what we see in front of us, because I can tell you now, I mean, I haven't got a calculator with me, but if I add on to what the Honourable Emsley is talking about, I can assure you it'll go off his calculator.
The difficulty we have, of course, is we sit here with this report before us. These other documents would be very useful. We don't have them in front of us. Now, we need to proceed on the basis of what we have in front of us, Chair. But it would be useful to get these documents, because maybe we need a second round at some stage. But really, I don't say... if we proceed, I'm going to proceed to ask questions on the basis of what I have before me, not the reports I have not seen. What do we do? Carry on.
Carry on the basis of what you have.
Okay, next item. Payment for the postage of our auto infringement notices without a contract. Who got that contract? I assume the post office.
Yes.
Now, how do you operate without a contract? I mean, what is a day-to-day basis? How do you do it? And who was responsible for this? 82 million rand irregular expenditure, payment of postage to the post office without a contract. Who?
That was the decision of the management at the time with the placing of the board.
And when you consider charges in terms of the PFMA, you would consider then levelling charges against those people responsible for making this decision?
Definitely. The issue is not only irregular in terms of what was followed. The other irregular part is that we were not supposed to pay any money for postage, because in terms of the ARDO Act, it's very clear that the issuing authority is the one that is supposed to be paying this money.
Wow, so that's a pure loss then.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
It's more than irregular. It should be under wasteful expenditure.
Yeah.
AG missed that. That's not irregular. That's a pure, simple waste of 82 million rand. Are you going to attempt to recover that money from any individuals?
The thought had not crossed their mind.
It cut it short. No, it's true. It hasn't.
Yeah.
Item, procurement of goods and services, irregular expenditure, 881,000. What kind of goods and services? Just give us a general indication. What kind of goods and services procured for 881,000 without proper procurement processes being followed?
It was venues, the procurement of venues, printing and stationery, attorneys, and a recruitment agency that was fired and that.
And again, who was responsible for this?
The management of the corporation.
Yeah. Next item, over expenditure, hosting of an international conference in excess of the budgeted funds. I believe the budget for this conference was 4 million something, am I right? But you went way beyond that, you doubled it. Budgeting, am I right, budgeting 4 million, 4 million odd, but you ended up spending 9 million rand, am I right?
Yes.
What was the conference about in Cape Town? What was it about?
It was an international road traffic conference that was held in Cape Town.
Again,
road traffic officers, road safety, and accident statistics practitioners.
Again, management responsibility.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. Next item, over expenditure, conducting provincial workshops. Now, in the 2009 column, we're looking at a figure of 3+ million, which was discovered in this financial year. For me, the very interesting figure is in the 2010 column. But there is no figure in the 2010 column, you'll say. And I'll say that is what I find interesting. How come you had no workshops? Because if I read your annual report, there's regular engagement, workshops with your staff workshops with your officers in the field. What happened there? Why suddenly no workshops in this financial year?
I suppose it is now being done regularly and within budget.
Okay.
Right, Mayo?
Okay.
The workshops were held basically in that particular year.
In a regular way.
Yeah, it was in 2008-09, where management of the department went around provinces in developing the safety plan for 2010 or 2015. And that happened in that year. It was never carried over to the next financial year, 2010.
Can I move on to fruitless and wasteful expenditure? Item 31.2. There's a table on page 149. Again, if you undertake the same exercise, my calculations are 2009 fruitless and wasteful expenditure of just over 700,000 rand. That again dramatically increases. If you do the calculations in the 2010 column, there's a dramatic increase there to about over 17 million.
On the draw, it's 18.9 million, from 1.3 million to 18.9 million.
No, but share
the balance. Oh, okay, minus
share
that
share
one point.
Balance.
All right.
The balance is from the preceding year.
Oh, okay, yeah, all right, no, that's fine.
And a major item there, and I think you have referred to it, is the Oracle ERP system was discontinued. What is the total budget for that? If you had continued with that system, what would the total budget have been? The total cost of that?
The total cost was 33 million. We had already paid 22 million for a system, for an entity of 150 people at a max. 8 million would have gone to licenses and support each and every year. Let's just account for it. If we were going to have it for the next 10 years, it means 80 million over the next 10 years.
You say 22 million?
33 million.
The total cost?
That's the total cost of finalizing the system.
But you spent 22
million? We had already spent 22 million of it.
Okay, these figures say 17 million.
We took out only the software and what we could not use, and the hardware, because it's still something that we can utilize it in the...
So you're using part of it?
We are using only the hardware part.
Can you please explain some of the small items in that table? Employees paid after resignation date, 116,000 rand. What's that? Who's responsible? What action taken?
This was as a result of us not having our own payroll system. We had DOT paying for paying our salaries. As a result, when people resigned, the DOT was not told in time not to continue paying those salaries. And so they continued paying those salaries while people had already resigned.
Who was the responsible person that I should have informed DOT?
It was our finance people that dealt with payroll.
And are you taking any action against those finance people?
Yes, we are. We did. As we are saying, the CFO has since been suspended as well.
And the next item, interest paid on settlement.
Wait, he has been suspended on account of this alone or?
No, all the other matters that are raised in the ministerial test team report.
So he's part of this on and off here?
He is one of the people that has asked for a severance of 6 months.
But he has cost us to lose 116,000.
We covered some of the money. What is the spending? We're left with 32 that we are still trying to recover.
I hope at some stage that we need to put names to these faces. I hope at some stage we get to know exactly who these people are, so in future encounters of this nature we can follow up exactly what action has been taken against named individuals. So I hope we get that information at some stage. Who are these people?
The CFO.
Long list of wrongdoers.
Mr. Manamela.
Yeah, but he speaks of management.
Yes.
Yeah. Then the next item in that list, interest paid on settlement of suppliers. I suspect you did not pay your suppliers in time there.
We did not. My understanding is that there were also SARS included in that interest penalty.
And responsible people, any action taken?
To date, the CFO has been suspended.
Chair, that's about it from my side, but I'm wondering if we've been skirting the problem. We haven't really come to what is at the core of the problem, I think, facing the entity. And quickly, finally, I want to refer to the CEO's report, in the annual report. Quickly, there's an interesting line there, which maybe the portfolio committee must deal with, or the deputy minister must deal with if the acting CEO does not want to respond. On page 5, the CEO's report, page 5.
Right.
Paragraph 1, 2, 3. Okay. The very first sentence, paragraph 1, 2, 3. Have you got it? I must stress, because I think we're looking for what is the root cause of the problems in the entity, and he makes a very interesting reference there. But we're hanging in the air, and perhaps he needs at some stage to explain. When he says, I must stress that some of the challenges facing the RTMC are part of its DNA, due to its founding legislation, the RTMC Act. I think we, and probably certainly the Portfolio Committee, needs to know what is it that we need to do to ensure that this entity is in fact put on the road to recovery. Does it mean we're looking at the Act? And perhaps more the Portfolio Committee than ourselves needs to look at that. Thanks.
It's certainly a matter in closing that I would like to raise.
Okay. All right. Still seeing Hoshi Masagi, Tambi, Shilwane, Pretoria, and then we're done. So we'll go around and then come back. Still?
Thank you, Chair. I want to go back to the point about the employees paid after resignation date. The explanation that we've been given is that there was no separate payroll. Now, what concerns me here is that in 2009, there was 147,000 that was reported as having been fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And the explanation presumably is exactly the same, that there was no separate payroll. And then in 2010, it was 116,000. Now, this goes beyond, you know, mere irresponsibility, when everybody knew what the problem was and nobody acted year on year. And that is what I find quite inexcusable, and I would like some sort of explanation as to how
when you have an audit opinion that indicates that this is the problem, it then carries on another year, simply because there wasn't a separate payroll.
Just a quick one, Chair. Just to refresh my memory, maybe Treasury can help us with this. Now, on irregular expenditure and fruitless, awaiting condonement. Now, after listening to some of the responses here, and notwithstanding the fact that we haven't seen the report that colleague Stuart has referred to, I mean, if an expenditure is not condoned by Treasury, irregular or wasteful, what happens? Is it just a net loss to the taxpayer? Is it charged to the department? Is it something that gets recovered? Because there could be millions that are involved here.
Okay. All right. Maybe let's respond to Steele's concerns, and then we go to SARS. National Treasurer, I thought that maybe the questions would be directed to you, so I wanted to respond to two questions.
We have our own payroll. Of course, looking back, we never had a payroll. We have rolled out an ERP system to the cost of less than half a million, and it does all the work that the 33 million system was supposed to have performed. Our costs for maintenance have been reduced from 8 million to only 70,000 each and every year. So we have now implemented a new payroll system to deal with those issues.
All right. Well, for one, some good news. That's good. National Treasurer?
Thank you, Chair. The matter speaks specifically to the irregular expenditure. The guidelines is that the legislation that should have been followed, that was not followed, which led to the irregular expenditure, that relevant minister can either condone or not. There was an example given about the tender process where it was a transversal tender, but they didn't follow the specific rules. In that case, the National Treasury would have not condoned it, and that's why it is reflected here. On the other matters, it will speak to the minister involved, and a lot of these matters speaks to either irregular in terms of the ARPA Act or in terms of the legislation providing for the different areas of expenditure. We then finally write a report back to this committee to make a recommendation as to what the committee's action could be as to whether that expenditure must come out of the department and they must pay it back, or the relevant entity, or whether there must be a finance bill written so that money can be written off and the final decision comes back to this committee.
Chris.
Chair, thank you very much. On page 149, under fruitless and wasteful expenditure, there's something very interesting there, which occurred in 2008-09. Which said rental paid for unoccupied premises. Can Chair, they talk to this? How do you pay an unoccupied? Where is this unoccupied? You might find that it's in my area that I'm paying, you know, under the name of my own offices. Where is this unoccupied? And how did it happen to be paid?
Which page are you?
Page 149, Chair.
149.
1, 2, 3, 4.
All right. Okay. Yeah,
the RTMC was basically located at Centurion, and at that time we then moved to Silver Lake. Now, in that process of the migration, the other building was not occupied. We were moving to the other one. So that's basically how it happened. It was during the time of relocation. From one building to the other, it was done in phases. But the staff had moved, so a number of other assets were still in the old building.
How do you say you have moved while you have got assets in there?
No, I'm saying what has happened is that the move was in a phased approach. What happened is that a number of staff members moved to the new building. A number of other things were still left in the old building. It was still within the lease period. However, they moved earlier than
why? We're talking about 390,000 rand.
Yes, this is a month's rental. This is a month rental at the old building, the Centurion building.
How much are you paying now per month?
No. Currently, at the new premises, we're currently paying 650 somewhere there. That are the new building.
No.
Currently, we
600 and something thousand.
Okay, let me put it this way. Move from Centurion to Silver Lakes. We then move from Silver Lakes now to a new building. And in the new building where we are now, we are paying 650 plus minus. I'm not quite sure of the figure.
Wait,
I don't want to say.
Wait. Make it 1,000 for me. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
650,000 rand per month.
Plus minus, yeah. For 4,100 square meters. In the old building or building in Silver Lakes, we're paying 450, but for 2,500 square meters.
Yeah, that's fine.
Thanks, you know, to him it sounded, I know it was just normal. We were just, you know, in transit, moving and remaining. To me, this money has been identified as fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Who is he then going to pay this money back to the state? Because somebody caused the state to pay 390 by default because of inefficiency, incapability, failing to plan things that by the end of February, landlord were getting out. So you said we will be out by that particular period, but somebody here, official to the yard, remains, you know, in that office and caused the state to pay this money. Who is going to pay the money back? And who is this person, by the way?
I would not have the information. I just have to go back and check because that is a thing that happened in 2008-09 at the time. At the end of the year, there was an argument from management at the end of 08-09 by management that it was not irregular. However, we continue to disclose as irregular, as fruitless because of that. But management at the time were actually saying that this is not irregular.
Yeah,
this is not fruitless.
I think my part is so. You argue with the Auditor General when you exchange management letters. But at the end of the day, there's a decision and a finding that is made. Once that is made, we don't go back to your argument because they serve no purpose. As it stands, this is a fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And the question is, in terms of your decision-making processes, who took the decision that we need to move a month earlier and thus incur this loss of 390,000?
It was a management decision at the time.
It was a collective decision. When you say management, it's a group of people.
Certainly of EXCO. Certainly an EXCO decision.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, I think we should not forget that this particular wasteful occurred in 2009. You know, 2010 came and passed. And then they are still, you know, struggling to see who was there, how did it happen. It means to date, they didn't, you know, even look at it. Can I conclude in that way? That the matter is as raw as it was in 2010. They've got no solution, no move, no, you know, recourse that has been attached to. Because once you said management and what have you, EXCO, Chair, if you look at the beginning of this book, you'll see two beautiful heads of individuals. And then these two beautiful heads are the ones who are, you know, as much as you can take this book and give your family and say, look at me, how good am I? It means it goes with responsibility. Once you are unable to say, it's Ntate Thobejane who should pay, you automatically say, I will pay. Because if you are unable to identify a person who have, you know, defaulted, caused misadministration of, you know, state resources, It means the accounting officer becomes the sole person who then says, in the absence of any person, here I am, my Lord, deal with me.
Mm. Yeah, because this fruitless is wasteful. In terms of the PFMA, the accounting officer bears ultimate responsibility of ensuring that the state does not incur any losses. And here we are, there is that loss. So the level of the question of liability will rest with an individual, and that is your CEO. And now, see in the level 12, it says on all the issues that your former CEO is charged, these are matters for which when you talk about accountability and you talk about financial losses, he bears responsibility. So, I think I would want to leave it at that. You want to make a follow-up?
Interestingly, they want to refute what is written in the report that says unoccupied premises. And what is further interesting is that the former CEO was Mbovu. It was not Mbovu at that point. Okay. My interest in this matter is, for how long will departments keep on paying for premises that they are not occupying? Because it happens all the time. It happens all the time, and this thing is never given a proper attention. My advice, the next time you intend to move, you move at one go. You don't leave other stuff at the back and come and try and explain that it was because the warm bodies were elsewhere and the furniture was elsewhere. It doesn't make sense to me. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Sure. I hope, Comrade Deputy Minister, you could note that down. Matladi and Dambi. And then, yes.
Chairperson, let me deal first with 148 and deal with an item entitled Expenditure Condoned. In 2009, this entity bought furniture without advertisements that had to be an open tender to the tune of 1.2 million. And this amount was condoned by Treasury. The following year, 2009, again, same mistake, expenditure of 499,000. Purchases without advertisements that were supposed to have been on open tender. Now, to them, why same mistake in consecutive years? And to Treasury, what are the reasons that make Treasury condone issues like this one? And is there any measures that you put in place that should be discouraging entities and departments to ask for condonement instead of encouraging them? Because as I was looking at 374 million waiting for condonement, 18.9 million waiting for condonement. It means in the next financial year, these amounts might be coming under the title expenditure condoned. That is why I would like Treasury to really tell us what forces them or pushes them to condoning this behavior. My last question, Chairperson, is pertaining to the statement of the CEO, the one paragraph that the Deputy Minister said to deal with. And my question is very simple. Having sat here for the day, listening to all the worst scenarios of activities in the entity, and finally, the admission by the CEO that there are challenges, and some of them are related to the founding legislation. The founding legislation. Do we think that this entity is necessary? Do we need it? Shouldn't it belong to one of the programs of the Department of Transport, seeing that even most of the work of the entity is done by consultants, as we have been reported to by the CEO? They would have a financial unit, they would do nothing, they would go for Deloitte and Touche to do all their financial work, when there are people that are earning salaries that are supposed to have been doing the work. That is double expenditure, Honorable Chairperson. I thank you.
All right, thank you. Very much a topic I'd like to talk to towards the end.
Okay, except the part that relates to National Treasury, if they feel they're in a position to respond to now.
Just before, the issue of condonement, if you look at it from that, this should have been expenditure ratified, because it's what was ratified by the board, and that's why it's still waiting for condonement by Treasury, so it hasn't been condoned by Treasury. Yes. I'm just saying, if you look at the last one, it says irregular expenditure still awaiting. So it tells you that we're still going to ask for Treasury to win. So it hasn't been condoned by Treasury. It was ratified by the board after it was done irregularly so by the management.
All right. Let me give myself Treasury. I see she's talking more to some of the issues that happened prior to 2009-2010. Are you in a position to respond to your question?
Unfortunately, Chairperson, no. But what we will do is we can send the members a report on the criteria used on looking at supply chain contraventions and the process that we look at. Obviously, the intention is not to allow for any condonement, because we have clear legislation and a constitution that wants us to go out on competitive tendering. But if that would suit the committee,
we will provide
the details.
Do send us, we'll keep it in our files, but safe to know that as this committee, we don't look and take kindly to condonement. I think we had one hearing last year where condonement was the predominant word in the hearing. So we know it is legal to do so, but it is something we really do not look at very favorably. Yes, Comrade.
Thank you, Chair. It's on the employees paid after resignation. You reported that you have recovered most of the money for the 2010 financial year, and there's only 32,000 outstanding. One would like to understand, because this is a clear case wherein somebody receives money which he or she is not entitled to receive. What is the snag in recovering that money? Also, I also need to be taken into confidence whether this one raised in 2009, the 147,001, was also recovered. I would like to know that. Secondly, it's with regard to both the irregular and the fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Your responses when Comrade Roy asked who was responsible, you always referred to the senior management. But I think you are not getting to the root cause of the problem, because now you've taken out the senior management, because as far as I know, when a transaction is prepared, there's a chain of professionals involved. It includes your accountants, your creditors, clerk. I mean, it's their responsibility until the last time it comes to the senior manager. What have you done about those officials? Because those are professionals who are supposed to comply with the legislation. And the PFM is very clear there on treasury officials, what their role is. What have you done with those other support staff who are also responsible for all these transactions mentioned?
Okay. Chilwane, let's move that.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is just a quick one. It's I'm just seeking a clarity from the Office of the AG, especially on the irregular expenditure at page 148, the item number 8, on which Honorable Ainsley mentioned that he's not sure whether it's a wasteful or it's a irregular or it's what. Just to hear the view of the AG's office in this matter. Item number 8, the 881,000,
82,000. Thank you. All right, can I respond? What have we done to the junior officials? Or the officials in the chain of command leading up to final approval by senior management.
We have given some final written warnings for certain things that they did. One of them, actually, we have opened a case of fraud, but it's not actually related to this. The person resigned and stole vouchers and tried to hire cars in the name of the RTMC. And we caught up with that, and we have opened a case. When was it? It was around November, October last year.
Why can't you open fraud cases against the senior managers that were suspended? Why couldn't you do that against them?
Our understanding was that once the police have looked at the report, they would then see fit who to do that. Because in that report, I can assure you that certainly there's more than 10 companies that the police must also go after. It's not only individuals in the RTMC. It's people out there. There is a lot of companies that we must go after for this thing. I would assure you that we are even in litigation with some of them, including the one that was supposed to roll out the ERP. Their view is that we must pay them the remaining 10 million, even when they haven't done the work. And our view is totally different. So this thing includes a lot of other people. I'm seeing the likelihood of seeing this thing at around 25 people. So you wouldn't want to go and single out certain people because then it will be selective. Our view is that...
Okay, no, it's fine. Yeah. To the extent that those three or four are your employees, you can initiate charges against, same way as these junior officials against whom you have opened a case of fraud. And by handing the file to the police, then they can expand it in terms of everybody that is mentioned. I'm just saying the determination to be able to take action against specific individuals. I think we'll probably leave here without being convinced that you people are acting with the necessary vigor in relation to. But anyway,
Auditor General, can you respond to the question from Comrade Chilwan?
In terms of the procedures and everything that we carried out, it was seen to be irregular in the fact that the procurement of the goods and services were not carried out in the normal procurement procedures, so that would be against the supply chain management policies. So in terms of that, that was very fine.
All right.
Yeah. So based on the answer from the AG, I'll then have a follow-up to the action fee or to check on whether the supply chain management team in your entity, is it intact, is it operational, and based on the response that we have, which I think during the audit you've had discussions with the Office of the AG on the explanation that was just explained to us, what has been done in terms of action taken against people who are responsible. And moving forward, because there's a problem of not following normal procurement processes when doing things like this in the entity, how are we going to deal with it? moving forward. Thank you.
We have hired an experienced head of supply chain that we have. What we found is that most of the people that work in supply chain, maybe as a result of the recruitment processes and stuff, had just been people that have been moved from elsewhere. It also looked like when you are a PA and you can't perform, the best way is to send you to supply chain to go into the work. That was what was the issue there. So most of the people that were in supply chain did not have any form of training in terms of supply chain issues. What we have done, we have retrained where possible. Most of them, of course, when the investigation was being done, did actually resign. We are now filling those posts with people with their capabilities going forward.
All right. I'm sure that you want to make a follow-up on
that? Yeah, it's not like a dialogue chair, just through you, to check on whether those that have resigned, we don't have anyone left in that unit. And if there's anyone who's left in that unit who was part of all these mistakes that we see today, has been action been taken against those?
As I said, some of them have been given written warnings. The ones that are left, most of them have been given written warnings as in as far as this is concerned. But we then, like I said, the ones that have resigned, of course, we are going to fill those posts with people that are capable. So we have done the work that we needed to do in that, and we are confident that going forward, there's nothing that would happen in there that we haven't checked. What we also have done is centralize the procurement of anything in the RTMC where the CFO will look at everything, and I myself will look at those things and sign them off.
All right. I think the problem of deviation from supply chain management policies was not a problem of the supply chain managers and the practitioners. It was actually a management problem, because management was lining that institution in order to do what they want. And sometimes you feel those posts with people who are incapable so that you can then be able to do what you want. So it is more a management issue than Pretorius and the new comrade. I see Singh and Tobejan, they're making signs. I'm not yet sure, I've not yet been able to decode this sign. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. My first question relates to the salaries and wages bill. If you look at the figures for 2009, the total salary bill came to 36.5 million rand. That was for a staff complement of about 140 people. 140 if you include the temporary staff as well, 140. And they got 5 new staff members in the current, in this financial year, which brings it to 145. I've been trying to find out what technical reasons there are for that huge increase from 36 last year to 53 million in this year, which is a 46% increase. That's while inflation in that period was probably between 5 and 6%, and we at MPs got 5.5% increase. So can I just get clarity, first of all, is there technical reasons beyond salary increases why there's such a huge jump in your wage bill in that year? Put it differently, where did the 17 million extra go to? Did it go to salaries or did it go somewhere else?
All right. Yeah, comment. Oh, okay. Wait, he's not done yet.
I want to answer first, then I'll carry on.
Okay, can we get a response to this question?
The increase is basically due to the additional staff members at senior management level.
Well, sir, the total staff complement grew by 5 in the period. You had 140 in this financial year, you've got 145. And we had extra senior staff members.
In the previous year, 8-9, majority of the senior staff members came at the very end of the financial year, and therefore, proportionally, the expenditure would have been less. But in 9-10, it was a full financial year.
Okay. If I can then refer you to the actual salary increases that certain staff members got, and I refer you to page 137 of the report. The former CEO had a salary package of in 2009 of 1.185, and that increased to 1.485, almost 1.5 million in the 2010 financial year. That translates to an increase of 25%. So you can carry on. Look at all of them. The next one got an increase of 17%, and the others in the same region. My question is, how did you determine, how is the entity's salary adjustments determined? Because this is way, way above inflation and way above what the rest of the public service got.
The salary increases in the RTMC is based on the DPSA. The reason that I gave is the fact that the CEO at the time started at the very end of the financial year, in the previous financial year, and the subsequent year it was then a full year. But the salary increases are in line in terms of the DPSA.
But the performance is not in line with the DPSA.
I must take your word for that, but I don't think that is totally correct. If you look at Mr. Rakuali's basic salary at that period was 653, and if you say that's not the full financial year, and in the next financial year it jumped to 732, that's about a 12% increase. Anyway, so my question relating to that refers to the performance bonuses. At the senior management level, this is now the organization which is basically falling apart, we've heard it from all over, two members received performance bonuses. Although the amounts are not huge, it's on page 10 of the report if you want to refer to that. Two received performance bonuses to the tune of 48,000 rand together, so let's say average of 24,000 rand, which is not big, but it's the principal at stake here. The question is, any of the people who received performance bonuses, are they on suspension now or are they still in employment?
We'll have to come back with that because we haven't disaggregated that to that level.
So what you're saying, it is possible that it could be somebody suspended who will resist?
Definitely.
It can be possible.
It can be possible.
Which is, of course, highly irregular if that should happen, but we'll get the information hopefully. So my second last question relates to credit cards. I need the confirmation, the guarantee, or the, let's put it as confirmation that your entity does not allow your staff to use credit card. You don't have credit card.
No, we don't.
You don't have.
Yeah. The ones that they carry around and walk around with, we don't.
Your private card?
No, yeah.
You just have your private card, no official card?
No official card, yeah.
Thank you. And, yeah, that's at least some sort of progress. It's a plastic, yeah. And lastly, so just another assurance, and maybe from the minister's side, that in the absence of a board, you don't have a board, you have the shareholders committee that runs the place with the CEO and with the executive. That in the absence of a board, all laws and regulations are complied with in terms of tenders, in terms of expenditure, etc. That you wouldn't come back next year and say we couldn't comply because there was no board. So what happens now happens above board. Is that the guarantee that we have? Thank you. All right. Yes, Kumbis.
Thank you, Chair. Almost forget what I want to say, but I will try. Most of my questions are answered. Chair, most of the questions are not answered yet. And what I like to know is, the acting CEO is saying that there were more than 10 cases given over to the police. But in the same sense, he said they give the report, they didn't study the report who was giving over to the police. And my concern now is there's so many outstanding
issues on in this report. Firstly, for me, is the rental of the unpaid premises extending from 2009, and now it's 2011. There's no payment made. Who is responsible for that payment? And on the delegation for the RTMC, I saw that Mr. Filet is the entity oversight for the Department of Transport, and he's not here today. In my sense, I'm seeing that he is here. Okay, sorry. It is oversight for the I expect for the whole department. So I like to know from him what did he oversight and what did they experience and what did they decided from this whole report, because I read quickly through the report here, and really it's shivering what's happening in the department. Thank you.
Slim?
Chairperson, thank you. Now, my question was related also to the nature of oversight of public entities by departments. What format do they take? Because there are lots of things happen within the entity. What was happening between the oversight responsibility and the entity in terms of figuring out some of these things?
Very small indeed, because I know that we are preparing towards ushering in the deputy minister. So I must, you know, ask a very soft question. And this question is on SARS payee. That human resource, you know, unit should every time do accurate calculation. But they have underestimated with something like 8,000 in this, you know, year under review. Previously, 93. Obviously, on 93, they will just said, no, we have already deducted 93,000 is back into the state. I mean, where it's supposed to go. Because this thing occurred basically because of somebody doing absolutely not what it has been hired and getting salary to do. Because human resource chair, I think they are the ones who are dealing with our, you know, the sense and the runs of our salary, what belongs to us, what belongs to them. Realizing that they failed, do they know this person who is sitting in human resource, maybe aligned with Ndata Manamela on that area? Have they already deducted this money from their salary? The year under review is very small. They can even get it in 2 months. Have they got our money back where it's supposed to be? Thanks.
Thank you. I think the problem there again was the personal system, payroll being done in the department. And the staff, the actual administration being done in the RTMC. But now that we have implemented our payroll system, we are able now to calculate everything accurately at a go.
This is a function of a payroll manager in finance, and it's not necessarily an HR function. HR would say this person would get this as a package. It has got to be structured within finance and all the other things that need to be filled in terms of SARS. We've hired the person who is a payroll manager there that does all those things now. Initially, we did not have that person who was sitting in the Department of Transport because we were using their payroll.
George, acting CEO knows that he was adding absolutely on nothing because that man did not even attempt to answer the question. The question is, where will we get this money?
That the Mandamela is not here.
Oh. Thanks, Chair.
Yes, he's on suspension.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I thought that when they add and respond, they're saying, we have now detected that because of the system flaws, now the money in this, you know, CIPO's pocket, so we are going to get. Because the interesting part here is we need the money back. The money should go where it's supposed to go. But as we are talking, somebody gets the package miscalculated without paying, you know, paying. And to, I mean, it's very little, this money, man. Like I'm saying, it's in the hands of managers. 2 months will be enough to get 8,000 and then close the chapter. Can we, heading B, saying we get the money, this is the process that is in place, getting the money. 93, it has already been done, I guess. That's why they don't even talk to it. Because it's a year before the year under.
But are we still owing first anything?
No, we are not owing SARS anything. This money that you see in there is fruitless and wasteful to the extent that SARS, because of our calculations, has penalized us and charged us interest. So these are interest and penalties from SARS for us owing them. So that's the money that has already been paid.
Has been paid?
Yes.
Right.
By who?
By us, because we are.
There's no us in this regard. It should be somebody who calls us, you know, to owe SARS this money. And this is the person who should pay the money. It cannot be us.
The RTMC, as an employer, has the duty to calculate the amount that is due to SARS. If we fail to calculate as the RTMC the money that is due to SARS, SARS puts penalties and interest. And this is to be paid by the RTMC and not an individual. So the mistake of calculations and where you haven't given SARS the money that is due to them is coming from the corporation, and the corporation is therefore responsible. So SARS, when they give out that penalty, they say RTMC, here's your penalty, RTMC pays the penalty.
I think we understand that perfectly well. I think you are not understanding him. Yes, SARS sends it to the corporation, and SARS is right. And RTMC should pay. But within RTMC, there is a person who is responsible, who made that miscalculation, who did not fulfill his or her duties as required, and caused the entity to incur penalties. So the point here is, how do you as a CEO hold your managers responsible and accountable? That's the bottom line.
Yes.
Because then it means if my helper does not do his job and RTMC incurs penalties, he has no personal accountability as a manager or as a senior manager. Then everything gets enveloped as an entity responsibility. I think that's the essence of his point. That when you incur penalties or you incur fruitless and wasteful expenditure, it means an individual within your entity did not do his or her job well. And if you're saying there are no consequences, then there's no reason why anybody should do the right thing, because anyway, they can always get away with it.
Agreed, Chair. As I said, we have now hired, we never had.
And I thought you would say your payroll was handled by Department of Transport before.
That's initially what I said.
Yeah. No, I mean now. That's what I should have said. Well, it was handled by DOT. Miscalculations were done from there. It means that the payroll officer there did not do the appropriate calculations. That's why when it went to SARS, they were able to come back to you and say, this is what you're owing us. But anyway, I wanted to move to DOT to say, the level of supervision, what supervision do you oversight? Do you do? How do you do it on your entity in a way that enables you to identify risks and mitigate for those risks in time, rather than to be reactive? It's fine, we have a report, it's here, but we're merely reacting. Are we able to to continuously assess our entities and see that this one is going to capsize and take active measures before things get out of hand. Because we have Mr. Pillay, you see that he's the acting chief director for public entity oversight. What oversight is he doing? How does he do it?
Okay, generally, the arrangement between the department and all our entities is we sign performance plans or their business plans, their strategy plans annually in terms of what they are going to deliver as agencies. So our oversight is lightly focusing on service delivery and the outcomes and all those sorts of things. Because corporate governance really is the domain of the board. We are supposed to monitor how they are spending their money, particularly on the project and service delivery side, not really on your general corporate governance areas. But however, we have also identified that is a problem.
So it's a risk to separate the two.
Yeah, that is a problem. So what we are doing are two things, is that the department will then ramp up its representation at the board, because we have a right to have a representative at the board level. Number two, to have our independent members who participate in the audit committees as part of our so that we'll be able to monitor on a day-to-day basis. But historically, as I said, there was that separation where they develop their business plan, we approve it as a department. But the business plan talks about your outcomes and your delivery. It doesn't talk about how you're going to manage the organization on a daily basis. And that has been left to the boards to do that. So I think what we're doing, those two interventions, hopefully in the future will help us have a much more closer involvement.
All right. I thought I closed that.
I'd just like one comment in respect to Mr. Tobiani's thing about SARS.
Well, of course, you're holding the green book. I'll allow you.
I just want to refer to the financial Bible, which is the PFMA. Section 51, and I'm saying this in the assumption that the accounting authority in this case is normally the board. Am I correct in saying that the accounting authority is the board? And there is no board, therefore it's going over to the shareholders, which includes the minister and others. It says an accounting authority for a public entity, and D, it says, must comply with any tax, levy, duty, pension, or audit commitment as required by legislation. So that, I think this covers the point that non-payment of SARS taxes. And the failure for not doing that is covered in section 86, which says an accounting authority is guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years if that accounting authority willfully or grossly negligent or fails to comply with the provisions of that section. So we might sit in a position here today where we greet the minister for the last time. Might be in jail next time when we get around here.
All right. Comrade Chair, I would like to give you the opportunity to have your say.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. What I would like to say is that we concur with the views that have been expressed by SCOPA on the RTMC. As soon as the Portfolio Committee on Transport came into office, we identified the RTMC as one of the worst performing entities within transport. And we dealt with that in twofold. We received information that was indicating that there was a huge mismanagement of finances, there were issues of governance, and there were issues of irregular spending. And we alerted the minister, and the minister had also received the same information, and he responded by saying that he was putting a plan in place, which he was going to report about to the portfolio committee. But at strategic planning level, where we then sit with the department and all the transport entities to look at their plans and their performance, and their financial report, we did identify that there was a problem. The first problem was around the fact that the RTMC had not fully executed its mandate. The second problem was that there had been a lot of turnover in terms of the CEO. The problem with that was that each time there was a new CEO, a new strategic plan was developed, pointing to a lack of capacity of governance at board level. But when we went deeper into problems, we also identified that the board itself was a problem. The third issue that we identified was that at the level of the department oversight, the department, before this plan, the approach that has been effected by the new DG, had operated at a more arm's length level without any involvement at board level that would enable the department to then provide an oversight. And also there is no nurturing process, because we strongly believe at portfolio committee level that the entity is a transport entity, which then means that it is an implementing arm of the Department of Transport. Therefore, the Department of Transport cannot operate at arm's length, although there is a board that is tasked with the governance responsibilities. And we would want to raise this issue as an issue that if a department operates at arm's length, there would always be problems in terms of ensuring that the mandate is executed as expected. We were also briefed by the minister about how the minister was planning to deal with the, how the minister had dealt with the problem. And the report, the forensic report, the minister reported of the process, and that there has been an investigating team. The issues raised in the investigation, although we had not seen the report, but the list of the issues that were raised, we concur with them. We also raised our own concerns relating to the fact that we would want to get the forensic report so that we can go through as a portfolio committee. We have not yet received that. We also recommended that the minister had to appoint an administration of the RTMC and delegate the responsibility to enable lawful decisions to be made. And also the issue that there was no board and the shareholders were not meeting regularly. It was an issue for us. And also the commitment from the department in rebuilding the RTMC was raised as a very crucial issue on our side. We have seen progress in terms of where things were in 2009-2010 in relation to where things are now moving forward. We are still to engage with all our entities in a workshop that is planned for 22nd and 23rd of March, where we will then see what progress has been made in relation to the issues that we have raised with the minister in terms of turning the situation around. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Comrade Chairperson. I do want to say, Comrade Deputy Minister, that having listened to the engagement since this morning, you would have noted indeed that there is a very serious concern from members around lack of compliance with legislation. Saying that for Parliament we make laws so as to regulate and govern the activities of organs of state, and when these are flagrantly disregarded, it is a matter of very, very serious concern, especially when you look at the subsequent consequences of that non-compliance. And the issue around the stability at the top, clearly there can be no organizational growth, development, when you have no stability at the top. And that is a challenge that seems to be littered throughout the various organs of state. And somehow it is a challenge that needs to be politically managed if these entities are going to fully fulfill the mandate for which they have been established. Top management, your audit committees, your internal audit functions, if these are not in place, then you may as well not even have the entity in place. And I think the question of exemplary leadership, especially from senior managers, well, especially from the minister, ministry, the DGs, to the CEOs, are very critical in setting the tone that would ensure that everybody within an organization is able to function appropriately. And for us, any institution that is funded with government money want to see value for money. There has to be value for money. And would want to see that these are being administered with the highest level of integrity. And raised this yesterday, the issue of consultants. As Matladi said, it's double pay. You hire people to do a job, they need to have consultants. I think it feeds into this thing of a state, a public sector that cannot function without a private hand. It just cannot be. You need capacity to be built. I don't think that in this country all qualified people have no sense of patriotism. You can't get qualified people who can come and work to serve the public. I don't think so. So we need capacity to be built. And I do hope, Congress Chairperson, that it might be important that together we somehow continue to cast a look in the direction of this entity to see what are the developments, how do we not only come to a slinging match, but how do we come and say, these are the challenges, how do we think this can move forward? And whether we may need to have another engagement where the full portfolio committee and ourselves sit down and together with the department and the entity and say, let's deal with the problems, what are the issues? So we look at them from all angles. From our side of COP and also from the side of the portfolio committee. I think it's something that we may need to sort out. As for the report from the minister, I'm sure it will greatly empower us, never mind the other negative possibilities, but which I think are far outweighed by the good that might arise out of it. For us as Parliament to be empowered, have side in the sense of the reports that have been presented to you, so that in our oversight work we also have a totality of the challenges and the things that have happened. So I would imagine that the reports, forensic reports, if it's different from the ministerial task team, as well as this one, are made available to us so that they assist us as well as Parliament to have a sense of how bad things were, so that as we build moving forward, we have a full appreciation of where we're coming from. I'm sure that can greatly assist us, not only as COPA, but I'm saying it is the portfolio committee, so all of us have access to those. But I want to give you the opportunity, Comrade, to talk to the issues that we've identified, and I'm sure amongst them as well is the issue of the board and its absence. And I think if anything has come very much to the fore, the fact that our comrades who are politically responsible have certainly not risen up to the challenge. Whatever the reasons, there might be many and valid, but effective. I'm not getting a sense that we have been able to rise up to the challenge of our responsibility. And thus, we could have a board that was just out of its depth. All the things that have happened. How do we address these things? Or how have they been addressed? When was the board dissolved? For how long are we going to sit without a board? How do we take the process forward? I think those are some of the things that we may be happy if you could clarify them, but as I said, you're free to talk to all the issues that, from where you're seated, you think might assist us. Thank you, Comrade.
Thank you very much, Comrade Chair, for those wise words. And let me thank also all the members of SCOPA, as well as our colleagues from Treasury and the Auditor General's Office. I particularly welcome the robust way in which you've engaged with us. I think that's very important, and that's why he was out of order, my colleague from the Honourable Member from the ANC on SCOPA, who suggested that as we were moving towards the Deputy Minister's chance that we should ask a soft question. On the contrary, you need to be asking robust questions. We welcome that, and it helps us also to do our job better and to learn lessons. The I think the first big issue that has emerged, let me say also we look forward to your report and we'll take it extremely seriously, but we're not going to wait for your report. I think that at least one major issue has arisen here, which we will instruct our colleagues both in the RTMC as well as in the department to push forward now with urgency, and that is the question of laying charges. I'll explain why I think there might have been some delay on this, but the fact is we must do that. And I think the point is taken that the charges shouldn't be general, they should be specific. They may well need to include eventually a whole range of individuals, as the acting CEO suggested, but there's no harm in beginning with four or five individuals where there's a very clear prima facie case against them. And I think that what we will instruct, I hope that's the right word, but we will certainly engage our colleagues there, both at the DG level and in the RTMC, to proceed with specific charges against some individuals. In so doing, and to indicate and to invite the police, obviously, to have a much more wide-ranging approach to any investigation. So we're not saying it's just these four individuals or five individuals, as the case may be, but the individuals must have names and surnames, and we need to move with that as quickly as we can possibly do it. So that point is very much taken, and I think that was perhaps the core issue that came through. Okay. There's also the irregularity, which Marissa Moore from Treasury raised around the ENET fees and the conflict between the regulations and other legislation. That's something obviously that we need to sort out at DG and look at post-haste very quickly. Our impression, by the way, was that we had tabled the ministerial report to the portfolio committee, and I think there was some in November when we met. I wasn't part of that meeting, but our impression was that it had been tabled, and perhaps there was some misunderstanding or miscommunication about whether it should be distributed or not, but certainly and I agree with you, whatever disadvantages or you know embarrassments there might be about it, transparency is absolutely imperative in these matters, and we've got nothing to hide. There are things that we need to be concerned about, but we want transparency in these matters. So certainly we've I think provided you with a copy, but we would like you to use that copy then to distribute to members of SCOPA, and we will certainly make sure that members of the Portfolio Committee on Transport also, as we'd originally intended in November, for them also to receive copies of that. There's been some mention of a second round, and I think obviously SCOPA needs to look at that, and maybe the report to the minister might provide you with reasons to consider having a second round or not, and that obviously is your business and you should decide. But if you do, I think that more than ourselves should be present. We should certainly be present, those of us who have come. But I think that the report would suggest that, first of all, we need to look, the shareholder should be here. So, prison holds no fear for me. I look back with nostalgia to my time in prison. We'd had lots of time to write poetry and so on, didn't have to sit in Parliament. I'm actually not part of the shareholders committee. I'm a deputy minister. The minister and MECs are part of the shareholders committee. And not all of them are ANC MECs, but you know, that's neither here nor there. But just to make that political point. And then forget that I made the political point. But I think very important, we missed an opportunity between SCOPA and ourselves as the department, not to say that the shareholders should be here. Because I think that there's a challenge, and I'll come to that in a moment. I think there's a strong case for the former members of the board, the dissolved board, also to come and explain it. And we need to start to set an example that, I mean, certainly, you know, when it's a SCOPA hearing, ministers, deputy ministers, members of departments and entities should be here, but we also, I think, should start to establish a practice where, you know, those who come from civil society, as it were, and serve on board, need to understand that they've got public responsibilities and are answerable to Parliament insofar as they serve on board. So I don't want to decide for you whether you want a second round and who you should invite or make sure does get invited, but hopefully when you do consider that, you will also look at the dissolved board. Then I think it's not just also, I think if you look at the reports provided to the Minister, Deloitte and Touche might also be an entity that you might also, on the basis of what you see in the report, you might also want to ask some questions. Because again, you talk about consultants and all kinds of entities. I mean, what the report tells us is there was a clean-up audit, okay, which is probably a polite term. I'm not an auditor. I've never been a member of SCOPA, so I don't want to venture too far in this area. But I think, again, that some of these big entities that are involved in auditing, I think they also need to understand that, particularly when they're auditing public entities, have a responsibility. And I think that should be considered. That would be a proposal without taking that further for the moment. Let me then... Those are some of the things I'm suggesting. A promise I'm making, we have provided you, and we would like the report provided to the minister, the minister's task team, for that to become available to Parliament and therefore public. Don't have a problem with that. And I've talked about some of the urgent issues that we need to take up now, which is, would in particular involve criminal charges, specific criminal charges. So and we thank you for being insistent on this. You're absolutely right, and we will take that up. Why haven't we done it with more urgency? This is not an excuse for not having done it, but maybe just a plea for an understanding of why. The political pressure we've been putting on the acting CEO and his new team, so we're not dealing with the 2009-10 culprits, if indeed they are culprits, but the new team, the political pressure we've been putting on them is to get the RTMC operating effectively, to move forward, and of course SCOPA's job is to look backwards and to do a post-mortem, correctly so. And I think that the strong conclusion I take from here is we're not wrong to say, I think we will understand as South Africans, we've got a massive, massive, massive challenge in this area of road fatalities and road injuries. Unacceptably high. Unacceptably high. 14,000, 15,000 people die annually on the roads. Serious injuries, 40, 50, 60,000. That's a crisis. That's costing our country 40 billion rand a year. And the RTMC is a very important coordinating mechanism to seek to address this issue. And it's been a disaster, as we can see from the auditor's report. Auditor's report is just giving us an audited version of the disaster. But it's a further disaster because it's set up to help us to respond as government in a coordinated way to this massive challenge. And so the pressure we've been put on Acting CEO Colin Letswale and his team is you've got to get the systems right, you've got to get the IT right, you've got to get it up and running, you've got to get the coordination going and so on. And I imagine that then having to pursue court cases against individuals and being tied up in these labor things and so on is a reason. So it's not what I'm saying is we need to take some responsibility. The pressure we've put, I think, correctly has been on moving forward, and we've not put sufficient pressure, political pressure, to say deal with the past and the post-mortem that SCOPA necessarily undertakes. But of course, what you'll tell me, and you'll be right in saying that, you can't move forward unless you also deal with the past and learn lessons from the past. So the point is taken, and I was really just entering a plea of some mitigation, but not to neglect the main theme that SCOPA is telling us. Just briefly then, Shepherd, if you'll indulge me, what is sort of rather coyly referred to in the acting CEO's introduction to the annual report, the DNA of the RTMC. It's a bit coy and it's a bit hard to know exactly. Think carefully, see, the acting CEO. There are very, very serious systemic challenges. Just remind colleagues that the Constitution, in its schedules, describes traffic policing, traffic enforcement, as a provincial and municipal function. Okay, so for whatever reason, those of us, I don't know if you care where CODESA, I was at CODESA, for some reason I was under pressure from those who were federalists in those days, we conceded this point that traffic policing was a provincial and local government and not a national function. So there's not a single national traffic cop, speed cop. Okay, we don't have it. But the very first Minister of Transport, Mac Maharaj, and the very first chairperson of the Portfolio Committee of Transport, not me, Patricia de Lille, realized, not to mention names, but you know, we're getting to local government elections, so quite correctly, both of them, appreciated that if we're to respond to this massive challenge of road fatalities and injuries and so on, we can't have an atomized approach to law enforcement on our roads. We've got to coordinate it in a variety of ways. They were absolutely right to do that. Now, how do you do that given a constitution which says that the national department, because someone said, you know, do you need an RTMC? The colleague there said, do you need an RTMC? Why doesn't the national department just take over that function? Well, we did have that function somewhat, but it was a function that couldn't coordinate and was very limited by the Constitution. So this RTMC was set up in legislation. I think the legislation was first passed, Stuart Farrow was there with me, or Ansley with me, before us. Okay, so we're not entirely responsible for the legislation, but it was there before us, but nonetheless. Which set up this entity, okay, which is trying to deal with the necessity of coordination across the country. So you can't have different uniforms, different, well, maybe you can, but different ways of approaching law enforcement on the road, different training or no training whatsoever in some small rural towns. The traffic policeman doubles up as the mayor's chauffeur and the local fireman and so on. So a whole range of huge problems. And one of the reasons why we're not doing as well as we should on enforcement on the roads. Hence an RTMC. Okay. Now, how to then get around with the Constitution? So what the idea was then you set up a shareholders committee. And the shareholders committee was the minister, there was no deputy minister, so out of the picture, minister and all nine relevant MECs. But it's not nine MECs, because then, again, another federal problem that was part of a quasi-federal problem, in a whole range of provinces, the function of roads and traffic enforcement and so on is split between an MSC for transport and an MSC for safety and security, for instance, in some cases, and so on. So currently, the shareholders' committee consists of 16 people, not minister plus 9 MECs, but 16 people, plus Selga, obviously, to then incorporate the local government definition. Okay. So that's the first. Secondly, when you're starting to coordinate functions, and even when there's then traffic fines starting now to be centralized, you can imagine that there's not necessarily an appetite, and I'm not pointing fingers at anybody in any province or any local government, but there's not necessarily a great appetite to make this thing work, because this is a revenue stream that you're receiving out of traffic fines, and suddenly now the direction of that is into a central pool. Okay. So I think that our historic experience has been that there has been less than enthusiastic commitment of the shareholders. Difficult to convene them, which is why I'm saying I would love for you to bring them here to Skota, and then for you to make the threats that you made to me, to them, so that they begin to realize that whatever the inelegance of the arrangement we've got, it's the law. And I suspect the law has to be changed. We need to look at this all again. But as long as it's law, and we must comply and assume our responsibilities for what we're doing. And I think it would help the national minister a great deal if the other fellow shareholders also have a sense that they can go to prison, actually, not least in the current circumstance in which there's no board. The board is suspended. So I'm not saying we should threaten MSC Carlisle from the Western Cape, who may or may not be from another party from the ANC, but I think all of them, and who hasn't been, who's been fairly committed to making this work, so let me not get over party political. But this is a problem. Okay. The next issue is board. A number of times, Chairperson, you said we had this board that was out of its depth. I hope that is the explanation. I hope that they were simply out of their depth and were not very active, interested parties. That remains to be proven, and I don't want to make loose allegations, but certainly my experience at some other boards indicates that it's not as though they're just incompetent. Sometimes they're rather too confident at understanding how to get around legislation and get around their duties. And so I think generally, it's not just in the RTMC, but generally, obviously with the RTMC it's a particular problem, because it's a board reporting to a shareholders committee that battles to convene effectively. And with a dispersed interest, it's not a board that is reporting directly to a single minister. So that's another challenge. But certainly, and do we need boards? Well, we do if the shareholders, in this case shareholders, are not taking their responsibilities seriously. But often, and particularly in the transport area, where you're dealing with entities which are essentially regulatory entities, a Transnet or an Eskom can understand why you would need a board. But it's a question I think we need to ask. It's a political question, not a scope of question narrowly, but it's an issue that we need to think about, and it is something that we're debating. So it's something that we need to come back to the portfolio committee on, this whole policy area and the legislation that affects the RTMC and indeed the RTIA and some of the other entities we're dealing with. We've got a whole lot of structural problems. We've got a constitutional problem. We're not committed to changing the constitution, but we need to find ways of ensuring that we have effective cooperative government, because this is what this is about, in practice. So I hope also those really are my concluding remarks. Just to say also that I hope that colleagues will also acknowledge that some progress has been made, not in dealing with the labor, or very little progress on the labor relations issues and so on. And we've been slow to move on charges of fraud, and we need to be more specific. But I hope also the colleagues will acknowledge that under the acting CEO, Colin Sirtswale, certainly that's our impression, and you might help us to discover otherwise if it's otherwise. We think that a young and energetic team has now been put in place You know, he mentioned the credit card issue, payroll, management of the IT expenses, which have come down significantly and so on. We think that we have in the acting CEO a very determined, in fact, the feedback we get is sometimes he's too tough and over-determined and so forth. But that's what we need. We need a significant turnaround. So I'm not asking you to give him some rubber stamp of approval and so on, but just to say, to convey our impression as the DOT and from the ministry side, that we've had a very bad situation. We think we are starting to turn it around, and I think that the hearing today, this morning, your report, and actions that we need to take even before we get your report, I think will all go a long way to really beginning to be very decisive about this. So thank you very, very much. It's helped us a great deal to do the things that we have to do.
Thank you very much, Comrade. I think, Comrade Chair, if I may, from our side, I hope my comrades here would agree with me. It might be necessary for us to touch base and agree on a date that gives us enough time to be able to get all the 16 plus 1 shareholders and everybody who was here today, that the Deputy Minister is covered. Because unless we deal with that element, I don't think we'll get anywhere. So that if the route is to amend legislation, then you can handle that politically with the Portfolio Committee so that some of these challenges that we are dealing with in scope could be obviated. But I do think that we need to dominate. See how we coordinate, and in for sure not less than 2 months, which might be very far, we must have brought everybody here so that we can sit down and talk to everybody. But thanks very much, comrades, for this engagement, Auditor General's Office, National Treasury, as well as the departmental officials for engagement. We have come to the end.